Discworld! It's Discworld! Podcast! Analysis! Yeah! Woo!
So I'm Josh.
I'm Sophie.
And we are your Unseen Academicals today, and we are going to be talking about or tracing the history of the vegetarian vampire. But before we get into that, Sophie, why don't you tell people who you are, what a vegetarian vampire is, and why you're the person I'm talking to about them.
Alrighty. So I am a sessional academic at the University of Melbourne, where I teach Gothic studies and research. And in 2021, I completed my master's thesis on the contemporary vegetarian vampire, and I've now turned that into a book. So in my conceptualization of the vegetarian vampire, the term vegetarian vampire is a catch-all phrase for vampires who no longer feed on human blood. That involves or incorporates vampires who feed on animal blood, vampires who feed on synthetic blood, and vampires who feed on human blood drawn from blood bags. The term, or where I first kind of picked up this definition of the vegetarian vampire was from Stephanie Meyer's 2005 text Twilight, which we will discuss later in the series of episodes, where the Cullens, who are the vampires in this novel, refer to themselves as vegetarians due to their diet on animal blood. And of course, in the novels, it's used as a joke because by feeding on a diet of animals, it's the absolute antithesis of what vegetarianism usually means in a human context. But for me, insofar as for vampires, feeding on animal blood represents a step away from their canonormative culture of, well, not quite canonormative because they're not canonormative, but a normative culture of eating, is analogous to a human feeding on animals.
Yeah, this term vegetarian vampire, which, as we'll discuss, does not originate in Twilight, but was certainly popularized through Twilight, has caught on in like academic vampire scholarship. There's articles coming out about vegetarian vampires that usually focus on Twilight and sort of the post-Twilight vampire boom, of which it is particularly characteristic. But yeah, they sort of, most of them, with some debatable exceptions, take this vegetarian label at face value, right? The fact that the vegetarian vampires are ostensibly feeding one step down on the food chain, right? They're abstaining from humans and going to non-human animals. They're claiming that that is a one-to-one relationship between humans not feeding on non-human animals and feeding on vegetables instead. But I, as the vegetarian scholar, have a big problem with the word vegetarian being thrown around to essentially reinforce the idea that there is some kind of quantitative or qualitative difference between humans and non-human animals that separates one as edible and one as inedible. So I want to push back against that a little bit as we go through this. But also the other thing we're going through is, a lot of this scholarship has been focused on Twilight and everything after, or even if they go into the Vampire Diaries and the Southern Vampire Mysteries, the books come before Twilight, right?
Yep.
Even if they go into them, it's like by way of the True Blooded Vampire Diaries TV adaptations that came after. So a lot of the focus on this phenomenon has been Twilight and everything after, which is where it is like most dense, most prominent, I think, as we'll get into. But as you and I have discovered from researching this sort of stuff, there is a long history of quote-unquote vegetarian vampirism. Yes, every time I say that in this podcast, it has massive scare quotes around it, but I will just use the term for itself. I don't know why I've been proposing like human abstinent vampires or human blood abstinent vampires or something like that. I think we need to come up with another term, but when I say vegetarian vampires, that's what we mean. But yeah, we're finding this goes back way before Twilight, which is where you and I have been working on something I am tentatively calling the Vegetarian Vampire Chronicles, which is literally tracing the development of this trope throughout vampire literary
Western history.
Yeah, Western vampire literary and film history and things. And then you and I are collaborating on something that will become either a book or a series of articles or something. We're not really sure, but just putting together this history and looking at the way the tropes develop, which readers of Pratchett's Discworld series and listeners to this podcast will be well aware that one of the major examples of this vegetarian vampire phenomenon that predates Twilight is, of course, the Vampire Temperance League in Discworld. So that is why it is relevant here and why we are publishing this as part of the Unseen Academicals podcast. But I think the way we're structuring this is it's going to be in three parts. So there will be a episode on the origins of the vegetarian vampire trope that pretty much traces the development all the way up until, well, throughout the 19th century for what's there, but primarily focusing on the 20th century up until the year 2000, the late 90s, which is when, of course, the Discworld stuff starts coming in. So the second episode will be entirely dedicated to Discworld, and I'll probably drop this introduction in there so people who listen to this podcast because they like Discworld and don't give a shit about vampires can just skip to that one. And when we do an entire episode that's like the length of the other two about just the treatment of vegetarian vampires there. So that will be episode two, and then episode three will be 2000 onwards. So this will be focusing on the modern sort of twilight paradigm of the vegetarian vampire. So that is the structure, and that's what we're going to do. All right, well, let's get into it then. When we talk about the vegetarian vampire, we are talking about blood-sucking vampires. There are subsets of things like energy vampires, plant vampires, even sort of space vampires that cross over with that sort of thing. And while I think there needs to be work done in that area, I don't necessarily want to do it or want to do it right now. I think that is the next step after we go through what I would call the sanguine vampire, right? The actual blood suckers. For a couple of reasons. I mean, energy vampires and plant vampires, they're not feeding on humans or animals, so it's sort of beside the point. Like, they are vegetarian by default. I mean, well, plant vampires aren't vegetarian, but they're vegetables. I don't know. It's like, it's a different idea. At least that's what
Well,
I
with
think.
energy vampires, at least in my how I like to conceptualize the vegetarian vampire, they're still feeding on humans, insofar as an example, obviously, would be Colin in What We Do in the Shadows. You're still draining humans of their energies. You're still preying on them, feeding on them. There's still a predator-prey exploitation relationship occurring that, and we're going to disagree on this, in my conceptualization of vegetarian vampires, of vampires who no longer use humans' food, it just doesn't fit into that category because you're still using humans for food. Yes, you're not taking their blood, but you're still taking their life force or their energy.
Yeah, no, I and within the earlier vampire stuff, like the blood, the actual physical carnal feeding of it is not really to do with like eating. It is more a symbol of this energy drain. So there's definitely something there that's worth looking at, but it is sort of a side point, and also especially in terms of plant vampires, sort of negates this idea of being vegetarian, right? It doesn't really apply. It's not really relevant. By removing the meat eating from the process, we no longer have a conundrum about meat eating, right? It invents different conundrums that need to be looked at in different ways. So that is to say that there are energy and plant vampires, but they're not what we are talking about here.
No, sorry.
What we are talking about is the modern vampire that I've already done a whole episode on this and when we did the Carpe Jugulum episode, so you can go back and listen to that about the development of the vampire trope. The modern vampire trope has its origins in the early 19th century with Lord Byron and Polidori's vampire short story, which was conceived on the same night as Frankenstein, thus dictating popular culture for the next 200 years. And Lord Ruthven in Polidori's vampire story is not a vegetarian vampire. He's just going around feeding on young girls. But I wanted to bring this up because Frankenstein's creature is a vegetarian. I have a book all about this coming out hopefully next year. But it's very interesting to me that the modern science fiction tradition that starts with Frankenstein and the modern vampire tradition that starts with Byron and Polidori is intimately tied up with the modern vegetarian tradition, which is heavily influenced by Percy Shelley, who is Byron's friend, who Mary Shelley marries and takes her name from. And he wrote the Vindication of Natural Diet that influenced the founding of the London Vegetarian Society thing. Again, buy my book, read
To jump in about Frankenstein, no one seems to recognize in the novel that creature is a vegetarian. And I think it's so shocking. As you say, we have the founding of science fiction, we have the founding of like popular vampire fiction. Both are so intimately engaged with vegetarianism, and it's just not picked up and discussed enough.
Oh, I know. It is definitely picked up and discussed. I mean, by me, by Laura Wright, by Amelia Quinn. Like, now it's getting a lot of recognition, but also I've just edited my Frankenstein chapter for publication, and the argument I make in the conclusion there is Frankenstein is not only foundational to vegetarianism and science fiction, but is also foundational to vegetarian and vegan scholarship itself, because in The Sexual Politics of Meat, Carol Adams has the entire chapter about Frankenstein there, where when she defines how female writers are able to promote vegetarianism by bearing the vegetarian word, the example she cites is from an earlier example by, I can't remember her first name. Homans, might be Susan Homans, someone Homans, who has a whole thing in defining feminist vegetarian studies about how the creature resembles Percy Shelley's vegetarian poet Alistair. So there is a long history of
Wow.
feminist vegan scholarship engaging with Frankenstein. Yeah.
I stand corrected.
Yeah, sorry. but yeah, Byron and Polidori, when they write the vampire story, which just to summarize, because I go into more detail in the Carpe Jugulum episode, but Byron comes up with a fragment of a story about a vampire, and then his doctor, Polidori, who nobody likes, so I don't know why he's hanging out with them, but he says, well, if you're not going to finish that story, why don't I finish it? Byron says, sure, whatever. Polidori finishes the story, sort of makes it a satire caricature of Lord Byron about him being a lecherous perv who feeds on young girls. And publishes that, which gets attributed to Lord Byron. Everyone thinks Lord Byron is the coolest. And then also the character resembles Lord Byron, goes on to influence what we think of as the modern Byronic vampire in general. But when this story is getting written, they're hanging out with Percy Shelley, who is a vegetarian. Mary Shelley, who was definitely a vegetarian while Percy Shelley was alive, sort of wanes later. So to go back to Byron, yeah, he's hanging out with Percy Shelley, who's the big vegetarian guy, Mary Shelley, who's doing vegetarianism at the same time. Now, Lord Byron is not a vegetarian, or he is at times, right? There's records of he's hanging out with the Shelleys, he's being a vegetarian, he goes away, he thinks that's all silly. Like, there's a very famous entry from one of his diaries later where he won't entrust his daughter to stay with the Shelleys because they might corrupt her and teach her vegetarianism and godlessness. So he sends her to a convent where she dies of malnourishment instead.
Ironic.
Hilarious. But there is a diary entry that I found that says at the time of Frankenstein and the vampires writing, when they were hanging out in Sweden, Lord Byron was practicing vegetarianism during that period. So, I mean, that's sort of incidental. That is just to say that the guy that the modern vampire is modeled after and who began, even if he didn't finish the first modern vampire story, was a vegetarian at the time. Now, that's not necessarily that important because it's not part of the story, except that when we get to Interview with a Vampire, which starts the more Byronic vegetarian tradition and arguably the modern vegetarian one, the main characters of that story, Louis and Lestat, are very clearly modeled after Percy and Byron, right? Lestat is Byron, who is trying to tempt the Percy Shelley Louis figure away from his vegetarian diet and to indulge in the pleasures of the flesh, whereas in reality it was kind of the other way. So that is just an interesting little coincidence at the start of the modern vegetarian tradition there.
I like that reading.
You know, that was when I went back to it later, I was like, oh, they're Byron and Shelley. It's so obvious.
I like that reading, and I have not come across it.
Yeah, especially when Lestat ends up being like a literal rock star and things in the sequels. Like,
Yeah,
yeah, okay, all right then.
and really lost her marbles with that one.
So that is, yeah, 1816, that story's been written and comes out. I think it's 1819 The Vampire gets published, so fairly early 18th century. Now, the next major significant text in the development of the vampire tradition is Vani the Vampire from the mid-19th century, which I again talked more about on the Carpe Jugulum episodes. I haven't read all of this. Have you read any of Vani the Vampire?
No, I haven't.
All right. I read and actually edited down the first volume because there are three volumes. This was a serial, and I think it's like there's like 400 chapters or something, and that are commonly published these days in three volumes. I have read the first, which is very interesting and has some very explicit similarities with Interview with the Vampire that I think are coincidental, but nonetheless interesting of like parallel thought development. So I don't actually know where the second or third parts of the story go to, where I'm led to believe Vani becomes more of a sympathetic, heroic character, whereas in the first volume he's sort of the antagonist. So maybe there's something there about him feeding on other creatures and things. I don't know. So yeah, and I don't have time to read this at the moment. I do want to, but they're enormous. The thing that struck me as relevant from the first volume is there is a section where the human heroes are discussing, like, well, shall we kill Vani, right? He's terrorizing our mansion. Shall we kill him? And one of them, I haven't written down who, says, you look upon this matter too seriously. Think of what he was, and you will soon acquit yourself of any such charge. I cannot know whether he was a vampire. If not, I have murdered most unjustifiably. This is when they think they've shot and killed him. And that jumped out to me because we have this idea of, is killing a vampire murder? And this hinges on the other character responds and says, well, what if he is? And then the guy who shot Barney says, even then, I do not know, but that I ought to consider myself as guilty. He is one of God's creatures if he were 10 times a vampire. So this is hinging on, is Vani human? Does he have a soul? Which is interesting to me because this, before we get Darwinism, which is coming up around the same time Viney is being published, really arguments for vegetarianism and meat eating hinged on these theological debates about whether animals have souls and if God wanted people to eat them.
There's, and I can't think of the name, there was a ancient Greek philosopher, it wasn't Pythagoras.
It's not Pythagoras.
It wasn't Pythagoras, it was...
Hoffrey's normally the other one.
Oh, it's not ringing a bell. God, this is going back to research in 2018 that I've now lost. But yes, there's a ancient Greek philosopher whose practice of vegetarianism was on the basis of soul transference. You couldn't eat an animal because of their soul.
This is Pythagoras.
Was it Pythagoras?
Yeah, Pythagoras is about you can't eat animals because there's reincarnation. You might be
eating
and
it's
a
like
human.
It might be the soul of your brother or your sister.
And you can't eat beans because the air escaping from a bean is could be a soul.
Oh.
Yeah. Pythagoras gets weird. And I think Porphyry might also.
So it was Pythagoras.
Well, if you're not directly quoting Pythagoras, this is the Pythagorean idea of vegetarianism. We've come a long way since then.
We have.
So they are having this debate about a vampire in Viney the Vampire. Which I just want to point out because, yes, in this case, rather than being identified with the humans as the predator, Viney here is being characterized as prey, right? We have vampires being associated with non-human animals, which I just thought was an interesting little aside. Mm-hmm. I'm not that familiar with the other 18th century texts. I've been trying to catch up on a few of them, but none of them have really stood out. And as far as I know, there aren't really too many examples that even flirt with or engage with this vegetarian human abstinent tradition. Do you know of any from the 19th century that we want to talk about?
There is La Hawler, but I haven't read it, so I don't know if I can speak to it.
I have read it, so do you want me to speak?
Go for it.
Okay. Yeah, the one that does get mentioned in vegetarian vampire stuff occasionally is the 1887 story La Hawler by Guy de Maupassant. This is where we have to start pronouncing all these names, which is notable for being a big influence on H.P. Lovecraft. I think he directly cites it as an influence for Call of the Cthulhu and things. I don't even know if it's a vampire story. Again, in the Carpe Jugulum episodes, we talk about how traditionally vampires were, you know, sort of just a general undead creature. So I don't know if we would call La Hawler a vampire these days. He's sort of just this, it's a diary of this guy who's living in this house. And he's like, there is an invisible creature in this house that is sucking my energy at night. So if he is a vampire, he is an energy vampire. And he also is like an alien, perhaps, or an alien emissary. It's like not clear, very Lovecraftian. But the significance of La Hawler in relation to the vegetarian vampire tradition is at some point the author leaves out a pail of milk and water for him. Or he notices that he's been drinking his glass of water at night, because this is how he knows that there's an invisible monster in his thing. Is every time he goes to get his water, it's been drunk. And he's like, who's drinking my water if it's not me? There must be an invisible monster in my thing. So he starts leaving out water and milk for him. So this is, he's sucking the energy, but he's also drinking the milk and the water. So definitely not a vegan if he's drinking the milk. And I don't know, how this plays in with the energy sucking stuff, or even if it's relevant because he wasn't drinking the guy's blood to begin with. That is something that gets mentioned. Yeah, I guess the one connection to feeding on humans, and more specifically feeding on non-humans, is there is a section of the story where the narrator is doing some research into what this creature might be, and he comes across an article about a group of Brazilians who were pursued, possessed, and governed like human cattle by a species of vampire which feeds on their life while they are asleep and drinks water. So he speculates that's what this creature is. So there it's being specifically identified as a vampire, and we are getting the allusion to it treating humans like cattle. But it doesn't actually feed on their blood or their body at all. It's an energy sapping sort of thing.
And they need water to wash it all down with, I imagine.
So this reference to this creature, this vampire treating humans like cattle, gets to the crux of why vampires are so scary, right? The thing about them is they treat humans the way humans treat other animals. That is the binary that is set up in vampire stories. And this also crosses over a bit with the more science fictional concept of the cattle dystopia, which I want to talk about very quickly, which is, yes, when you have aliens usually coming to Earth and treating people, rounding up people to feed on their homeland. Now, the first, the formative and most popular of these stories is, of course, H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds from 1888, where the Martians come to Earth. But this is a vampire story. The Martians come to Earth to drink people's blood specifically. They're not eating people and farming them. They are drinking their blood. So I think it is often overlooked and was a bit of a, oh, you're an idiot moment when I realized it, or someone in the literature pointed out to me. But War of the Worlds is a vampire story and is one of the most popular and influential vampire stories, right? It has the whole alien invasion subgenre spinning off from it. And H.G. Wells did not like vegetarians, and you can read all about that and why in my book. But a lot of War of the Worlds is the narrator reflecting on how humans are being treated like other animals. And he sort of reflects on, like, you know, should we be doing this, right? And H.G. Wells would say, yeah, we should. We're humans, we're in charge. It's just a fun story to say, what if we weren't? But this story was actually picked up in vegetarian periodicals and publications of the time and promoted in multiple vegetarian magazines as a good story for vegetarians to get their friends to read so that they could start thinking about what it would be like to be treated like farm creatures and things. So, yeah, I mean, my whole argument that I make about H.G. Wells is he keeps writing these stories where he's trying to be ironic, and then all the vegetarians come along and go, good point. And War of the Worlds is one of those where we have actual, like, textual published evidence of that happening. And yeah, this gets picked up in the vampire tradition as well. Some notable examples that I won't go into, but just to list them off here, we have the 1979 Australian film Thirst, which is very cool. A very science fictional vampire movie, but one where vampires are rounding up people and draining them of blood in the blood bags. This is sort of an early example of what you see in movies like Blade Trinity, Night Teeth.
You see it in Buffy.
Yeah. Daybreakers from 2009, another Australian film that I really didn't like the first time I watched it and really, really liked the second time I watched it. It gets brought up a lot in the environmental vampire literature because this is about vampires facing a food crisis when they realize they're running out of humans to feed on because they keep turning them into vampires. Yeah, good movie. Have you watched this one yet?
Yes, I love it. Ethan Hawke is just so beautiful.
This is a thing I'm learning.
I'll watch him in anything, except there's a movie he stars in with Angelina Jolie where he's like a crazy psychopath serial killer and she's the FBI lead of the investigation, and he ends up romancing her. And then, you know, in the throes of passion, she realizes that he's the murderer. Oh, it's such a good
Taking
movie.
Lives. From 2004.
Yes. Good Google. That was a very quick Google. Quick question for you. In terms of, you know, aliens feeding on humans as a cattle dystopia, where does the Matrix figure into your thinking? And had you not thought of the Matrix?
I hadn't, because again, this is the energy vampire distinction, right? They are they are sucking their energy, but they're not necessarily feeding on them. So I hadn't made that analogy to meat eating, but yes, if we want to bring energy vampires into this, that is definitely an example of, we have robot energy vampires.
We're going to have to do an energy vampire one, aren't we?
Well, yeah, eventually. Not in this one. That's number two. We're setting up. We're teasing for the sequel. We have a post credit scene where one of those floaty things from the Matrix pops its head and it goes, "Woo!" yes, and also just to bring it back to Discworld, of course, another prominent example of a cattle dystopia that we will talk more about in the second part is the Discworld vampire novel Carpe Jugulum, where we have the vampires in the town of Escrow creating systems for feeding on the human inhabitants of the towns, and the entire morality of that hinging on whether you should treat people like objects or the way people treat other animals. So more about that in part two. But that is sort of the 19th century origins and the basic assumptions that are being embedded into the tradition, which really gets exploded and developed in the later half of the 20th century. During the first half of the 20th century, both in terms of vegetarian vampires and just vampires in general, not much happens apart from a whole bunch of Dracula film remakes.
So perhaps, and a big perhaps here, one of the earliest examples of a vampire who is still not a vegetarian, but who is seeking release from the curse under which they labor, is Universal Pictures' House of Dracula, which was released in 1945, in which Dracula and the Wolfman, the supernatural beings at the center of this film, having grown tired of their afflictions, attempt to find ways of escaping the curses upon them. Perhaps one of the earliest examples of a vampire trying to feed differently and not on human blood, but the extent to which we can believe this is muddied in the film, not unlike the Dracula tapes, which we'll get to in a little bit. Because Dracula rocks up to the doctor's house, or I should say not the house, his medical room, or his patient rooms, wherever they see people. And there seems to be this unspoken connection between the assistant, who's a hunchback, and it's also Mina from Bram Stoker's Dracula, the characters reimagined in this film as a doctor's assistant, and Dracula. They have this weird, highly sexual moment where they're just staring at each other that's broken when the doctor walks in. And he, or Dracula, supposedly comes to the doctor to seek treatment for his vampirism. He no longer wants to be a vampire. He no longer wants to feed on human blood. However, in the course of undergoing treatment, Dracula repeatedly tries to hypnotize Mina and bite her to turn her into a vampire and become his eternal lover. And those attempts are frequently thwarted by the doctor and another nurse who works in the practice. But then while receiving the treatment to cure him his vampirism, the treatment takes the form of blood transfusions from the doctor to the patient who is Dracula. So highly unethical, also highly reminiscent of Stoker's Dracula, wherein, you know, Lucy's dying and the crew of lights, the humans in the text that try to save her and also who want to kill Dracula, all donate blood via a series of transfusions to try and save her life. In the middle of receiving this transfusion, however, Dracula both appear to have taken some sort of laudanum to put them asleep and, you know, an early version of anesthetic. Yet Dracula wakes up and drains the doctor of his blood, then replenishes the doctor with his own blood. So he comes to this, you know, doctor under the guise of, I don't want to be a vampire, I don't want to feed on humans, only to feed on humans. The motivation's never explained in the film as to, you know, is he really there because he doesn't want to be a vampire? Perhaps he's suddenly overcome with desire for Mina and morals or potential morals go out the window. But it is, despite all of that, one of the earliest examples of a vampire at least potentially wanting to feed alternatively to feeding on human blood.
My memory of this film is kind of hazy. It's one that washed over me a bit, but
oh, it's a shocking film.
It's not great, but I remember, like, the ending is sort of that, because you have both Dracula and the Wolfman. Like, this was the first like crossover of all these.
Oh, and then Frankenstein. They find the Frankenstein
monster. Yeah,
in the caves underneath the practice, and I think Frankenstein's the one that comes and saves the day.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You have the parallel treatments of Dracula and the Wolfman, who are both seeking to, like, become human again, and the Wolfman is treated as the more sympathetic character, who, like, he is human half the time, but he just has this monster, which we have a bit of a debate about in the second episode about, whether werewolves or vampires are considered more humans. But while vampires can pass as human, they are biologically inhuman 100% of the time, whereas werewolves, it's like, well, half the time they're human and then they have this monstrous side. So in House of Dracula, the Wolfman takes on the more heroic, sympathetic role, whereas by my memory, Dracula is sort of, revealed to be the villain of the story. Whether it was his plot all along to infiltrate the house or if he's been turned by the temptations of Mina is sort of somewhat ambiguous. But it's sort of implying that while the Wolfman has this human side that he can appeal to fight the monster, Dracula is just inherently monstrous. And even if he wants to, and whether he does or not is debatable, but even if he wants to,
he's unable
he can't
to
fight his urge to feed on humans. It just is what a vampire is. So it's sort of reinforcing that alignment between vampires and carnism there. The second Universal Dracula film, so the sequel to the original Dracula, is Dracula's Daughter, which is notable for being, this is what Anne Rice says she bases her idea of the sympathetic vampire of, but while she doesn't seek to release her curse for herself from a curse, she is thankful that she's been released from a curse. Like, the start of that movie is her showing up and going to Van Helsing, like, you killed Dracula and now I'm human again, like, thank you. So there's somewhat of a hint towards this, you know, seek for a cure in that film, but then also that film does the same thing where it twists around and goes, no, she was an evil vampire all along, you silly fools.
But I think it's not really until Anne Rice where vampires, you know, singular nature as evil becomes troubled or changed. You do get the emergence in Anne Rice of a vampire that can be good.
Right.
The reason for that, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts.
Because she wants to have sex with them. Actually, no, I take that back, because the vampires in Anne Rice specifically cannot have sex and cannot get erections.
And they also don't engage with humans, or at least in Interview with the Vampire. They're observers of the world. They're not participants.
Yes, and that is the transgression that Lestat does, that by becoming the rock star and revealing himself, he is no longer an observer.
No.
I need to finish that series, but all the books are very long.
I do not like Anne Rice's novels.
I'd love that shit. No, I really like them. But so I've read, like, the first three that everyone read. So the Interview with the Vampire, then Lestat and Queen of the Damned, which sort of are one story. And then I did for this go and read one of the later ones. I think it's like the eighth book in the series, Gold and Silver or something, because it said it had a vegetarian vampire in it. It doesn't. But it was like, and again, just tells the same story from a different perspective. This one's the Marius book. He's like the oldest Roman vampire. So we get all of this story just again, but what if from this guy? And like every time I look at one of these books, they're like 700 pages long. They're retreading the same thing. They have this very slow gothic style to them. But every time I read one, I'm like, oh, this is the sickest shit. Like, I love this stuff. But then I finish it. I'm like there's a refractory period. I'm like, not for a while. Like, I can't just jump back into another one of those. So they're very daunting. But yeah, every time I'm actually reading one, I'm like, oh, this is awesome. Marius fucking rules. He's the coolest one. He can shoot fireballs.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah, no, I was wondering where the vampire powers trope had come from, because that's another sort of Twilight thing where post-Twilight, now all vampires have individual superpowers, but it does happen. It's in the Anne Rice books, not so much in Interview with the Vampire, but later on they all get their individual powers. There's the killing power and the fire power and the air power and things.
I guess it's a natural progression, because even Dracula has, you know, powers. He's got telekinesis, he can shift into a bat,
powers, but I think the distinction is like these individual powers, where rather than all vampires having telekinesis, it's only the Cullens.
Certain ones, yeah.
So it becomes like a superhero team up thing, which literally happens in the what's the final Twilight book?
Breaking Dawn.
Yeah, where I was watching that movie, because I haven't read that book, but I'm watching that movie. I'm like, why is this like an Avengers vampire team up where they go and get the Rami Malek vampire who can shoot fireballs? And I'm like, all right, let's go.
His power is he can control weather, everything, meteorology. So he can also cause earthquakes, and it's pretty cool to think that was like Rami Malek's, like one of his first, you know, starring roles. Dakota Fanning is so bad in it.
She's very awful.
She's such a magnificent actress. And then they had a clip on telly the other night, and I was watching with mum, and she was just nagging me with, oh, who's that, what's that, why are their eyes red, what are they doing now, gosh, they're all very pale. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, Mom, if you want to read about Twilight, buy my book. Buy my book and read my chapter on Twilight, because I'm not sitting here to discuss this with you.
Yeah. Another crucial step in the advent of the sympathetic vampire that takes place in the 60s and 70s is the American sitcom Dark Shadows, which ends up centering around the vampire Barnabas Collins, who, like Dracula in House of Dracula, wants to give up blood but can't because of his biology.
Like, the key thing with Dark Shadows is that it's another along the trajectory of vampires wanting to give up feeding on human blood, before Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire, where we get the first example of a vampire being able to choose to feed differently, in Louis's case, as we'll see in a minute, by feeding on rat's blood. But in Dark Shadows, they had initially Barnabas as an evil character introduced to just terrorize the town of Collinsport at a time where ratings were quite low. And due to, you know, the popularity of Barnabas as a figure, they actually rewrote him by virtue of a flashback episode, and flashbacks then became, you know, a recurring trope in the series, and they did multiple throughout the course of the however many seasons there were. And as per the show's mythology, he becomes a vampire after being cursed by a witch whose love he spurns. And then from that day onwards, Barnabas became a sympathetic vampire, so a vampire at odds with his ontology, doesn't want to be a vampire, is miserable, and really struggles with his thirst. Whereas, you know, prior to that flashback, you had many scenes of Barnabas feeding on particularly attractive younger women, killing people. He had a familiar, Willie Loman, who would, you know, lock up his victims for him. But the significant point about Dark Shadows is that one of the first times, again, or one of the more popular examples of a vampire wishing to change the way he feeds and no longer wanting to feed on human blood. But try as he might, he, again, similar to House of Dracula, enlists the help of a scientist. In the show, it's Dr. Julia Hoffman, to run experiments on him and to, again, try and cure him of his vampirism scientifically, which it becomes such a theme in more modern works, you know, that amalgamation of science and vampirism, which is I don't love.
That's my favorite part of it.
Yeah, no. Look, I like the paranormal romance. You like the science. But yeah, so it's really interesting that you have this really popular, and like Dark Shadows was the number one primetime show of its era. It was huge. Cookbooks were released, books were released.
Yes, I mean, we talked a bit about Dark Shadows in the Carpet Jugnum episodes, but in terms of its significance to the vegetarian vampire role, he's not one. But whereas in House of Dracula, we had this shift from Dracula as a sympathetic character who's trying to give up feeding on humans and then it becomes villainous when it's shown that he can't resist. Here we're getting the opposite, where he is introduced as villainous. And then as he becomes more heroic and more sympathetic, it's increasingly emphasized that he's trying to find an alternative to feeding on people. And this is really like sort of a turning point in the vampire tradition, as I discussed on the Carpet Jugulum episodes. But this is where we get the advent of sort of the modern sympathetic vampire, which is primarily solidified and popularized by Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles series, which begin with Interview with the Vampire in 1976 and is usually pinpointed as the beginning of the vegetarian vampire tradition in vampires. However, I was very excited to discover that the first vegetarian vampire is in fact Dracula himself, although not Bram Stoker's Dracula, but Dracula from Fred Saberhagen's The Dracula Tape, published a year before Interview with the Vampire in 1975, and featuring a very similar storyline where the narrative is presented as a first-person narration of Dracula's life that he is recording on a tape that he leaves in the back of a cab. Yeah, I talked a bit about this on the Carpet Jugulum episodes. I do think it is a coincidence that he is publishing this before so close in proximity to Anne Rice. Like, just the fact that they come out a year apart means that it would have been already in the publishing pipeline. Like, she wouldn't have had a chance to read it before she submitted her manuscript or anything. So I don't think she's reading this and ripping Saberhagen off or anything. But we have some parallel development where the two key texts in that are sympathizing vampires take the same approach of presenting a first-person narrative that recontextualizes some of the traditional vampire tropes and ideas. I mean, Rice's story is an original narrative, whereas Saberhagen's just going through the story of Stoker's Dracula and presenting it from Dracula's point of view. But crucially, in both these stories, part of the attempt to make the vampire sympathetic is that they don't drink on humans. So Saberhagen's Dracula says he never drank on human blood, except I think he says sometimes he does, like when he's having sex and the girl really wants it. So there might be some voluntary feeding going on there. But in terms of his day-to-day feeding, he says he only feeds on non-human animals, and like specifically takes a lot of scenes from Dracula and explains how he wasn't feeding on humans. Like, there's the scene of the castle at the start of Dracula where Jonathan Harker sees him like dragging in the sack.
The bag of children.
Yeah, he assumes it's a bag full of children to feed to his wife. But Dracula says, "Well, you're all just taking Harker's word for it. He never actually saw what was in the bag, and in fact, it was a goat."
There is the mother that comes to the gates of Dracula's castle and is like, "Give me back my child," which, you know.
I mean, he does point out that Dracula, as in Stoker's Dracula's narrative, is like, it's an unreliable narrator. I think that is an interesting observation, that all the prejudices are Harker's prejudices and everything is hearsay. Like, he never actually sees Dracula feeding on people. It's all assumed. I think he sees her feeding on Mina, but like, Dracula's like, yeah, but she wanted it. The other layer to the Dracula tape is this all bullshit on Dracula's part, because he is himself an unreliable narrator, and is he just doing this to clear his name and present an alternative history so that he can be more sympathetic? Like, in Interview with the Vampire, we're meant to take Louis' story at face value, whereas there is some deliberate like deviousness to Saberhagen's Dracula that perhaps he is full of shit. This does not really get carried through in the sequels to the Dracula tape series, which are all about him fighting crime and ancient fairies with Sherlock Holmes. But
With some, what was it, Dracurati?
Dracarati. Yeah, I don't know if he knows Dracarati, but he is the satanic half-brother of Sherlock Holmes, who has fairy blood. That is established in the second book. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the big one then, Interview with the Vampire.
So I guess the starting point would be, as we've already spoken about, in contrast to the story of Dracula and the House of Dracula and Barnabas and Dark Shadows. And I might not have said this explicitly, but in both those examples, there is an effort to extinguish the vampire's blood loss. So completely eliminate it, right? Rice offers a radical alternative in lieu of extinguishing the vampire's thirst. Instead of extinguishing the vampire's bloodlust, Rice ushers in animal as a substitute for human blood. And in so doing, it does split the vampire's previously singular dietary path. And as you see in the novel, it also really troubles that idea that vampires are singularly evil. As Josh noted, that is in large part due to the first person narration. It's really important that in Dracula, Dracula, you never hear from the vampire's perspective. All you hear from is, the vampire hunter's imperial colonial perspective. But in terms of, Interview with the Vampire, you hear Louis speak, you hear his thoughts, you experience his turmoil and his real struggle against his thirst for human blood, which becomes kind of the overarching theme, I would argue, of the story. Now, it must be noted that Louis does eventually succumb to his thirst for human blood. He only lasts something like 70 pages out of a 400-page novel subsisting on rat's blood and chicken blood. So he doesn't stick with it for all that long.
And also is a huge pedophile.
Well,
Which it
he's
occurs to me,
definitely.
my Byron Shelley reading, that then the
Yeah.
Kirsten Dunst character is therefore Mary Shelley, who Percy Shelley did
Yes.
elope with while she was, what, 15, 16?
But with that said, I think we do have to keep in mind the time in which they were written.
What, the 70s?
No, like Shelley running off with and they don't engage in anything sexual with Claudia.
They do. There is a line in Interview with the Vampire where it says, "She was my daughter. She was this. She was my lover." It makes it explicit that they have
But
sex.
they don't ever engage. Like they share a coffin, but they sleep. They don't, there's no mucush
He calls
mucundi.
her his lover.
Yeah, but I don't think it, there's not, they don't, there is no evidence apart from maybe that use of the term lover, but
How is that not evidence? What does lover mean other than that they had sex?
you don't see it happen
No, but we're
because the
told by
whole point,
him
Louis
that it
feels
does.
so much guilt over her being stuck in this child's body and she has these urges that she acts out with Madeline, who's her human.
Her maternal aunt.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Hang on, I'm going to find this line. I thought of that singular experience I'd had with her and no other, that I'd killed her, taken her life from her, had drunk all of her life's blood in that fatal embrace I'd lavished on so many others, others who now lay mouldering in the damp earth. But she lived. She lived to put her arms around my neck and press her tiny cupid's bow to my lips and put her gleaming eye to nay eye until our lashes touched, and laughing we reeled about the room as if to the wildest waltz, father and daughter, lover and lover. So we are seeing them kiss.
Again, people kiss their parents on the lips, and we're not being told
Lover
it.
and lover, father and daughter, lover and lover.
All right, I'll let this one slide, but if a kiss is all we're hanging this hat on, it's a
No, I'm
pretty.
hanging it on lover and lover. That is what I'm hanging it on, which tells us that the love is reciprocated from her. It's not just his desire. It's we are lover and lover. You can
Well,
imagine
yeah.
how well it was that Lestat did not envy us this, but only smiled on it from afar, waiting until she came to him. So, yeah.
Mic drop.
Just
But
some seedy bullshit.
yeah, I guess, or at least what I think is the important thing about Interview with the Vampire in terms of the trajectory of the vegetarian vampire that we're tracing is that it ushers in the vampire's capacity to choose not to drink from humans, to drink instead from animals, and that is huge.
Yes.
If vampires are, if we define them as typically creatures who survive on human blood, who have to drink human blood, this shift in the narrative, it's major, and the repercussions it has on the types of relationships that are available to humans and vampires, the transformation of the vampire from this figure of horror and horror fiction to a sympathetic creature, that we, feel sorry for. We feel sympathy, we understand their struggle, and suddenly it's a matter of, you know what? Feeding, like I can understand your need to feed on humans. It's no longer necessarily a source of horror, but you feel sorry for someone that they have to resort to feeding that way. And Louis himself, Dracula's all about, he wants to make Mina his bountiful wine press for a while, versus Louis, who's when he resorts to drinking human blood again, takes deliberate steps to remove himself from the act of feeding and just like starves himself to the point where, kind of the beast within takes over and he just drinks and then once again starves himself to try and take away any sense of autonomy from the action. It's not him acting anymore, it's just the biological need taking over and away he goes.
I mean, this is a sort of Derridian shift from like eating good to eating well, right? We're moving past the idea of curing vampirism. Like, we've accepted that I am a vampire, I have to eat, drink blood. So how do I do that well, right? What is the best way to drink blood if I accept that I am going to have to? The problem with Derrida is that he ascribes that to people who I would argue don't have to eat meat,
No.
whereas the premise of the vampire is it has to drink blood. Yeah, but this does get developed into a more coherent philosophy in the sequels, in the later Vampire Chronicles books, specifically the one that I've read. So I skipped a bunch of them and went to Blood and Gold, which I think is like the seventh or 8th book. This is the Marius book. It is essentially retelling the story of Queen of the Damned from his perspective. The reason I jumped to this one is it's said that the premise of the book was Marius unearths a vegetarian vampire from beneath the ices of, I think it's Alaska or something, but there's another ancient vampire who is a vegetarian vampire and then seeks to install a vegetarian philosophy upon the vampire council. That is not what happens in this book. The vampire that he unearths from the ice is this dude named Thorn, who's like a Viking, and he is a vegetarian vampire in that while he is trapped underground in the ice, the only way he is able to feed is to telekinetically drain the energy of animals who walk above him. It's sort of a necessity thing rather than a philosophical thing, plus it's an energy thing rather than a blood thing. Thorn also is set up as this really, really cool character, but then his entire function is the story as he goes, or him and Marius are hanging out naked in a spa together, as you do. And he's like, "So, Marius, what's your deal?" And then that is the prompt for the next 800 pages to then be Marius retelling Queen of the Damned. But part of what's going on here is Marius has got this, it's sort of the opposite. Rather than Thorn seeking to instill this vegetarian philosophy, Marius sort of takes on the Lestat role. In that he is like fathering Thorn, who he's got up from the ice, and he's like, "Well, you're out of time. Let me show you our modern ways." And part of his modern vegetarian philosophy is actually Marius's vegetarian philosophy is, okay, we have to drink blood. And the way he solves it is not to drink animals, but he says, no, we have to feed on people, but we drink from them, but we do not kill them, and we only take blood from evildoers, right? Sort of his Bush language, right? This book comes out in 2001, so I don't think the term evildoers is a coincidence there, if you think about the George W. Bush speeches. But and this is what Louis and Lestat do in Interview with the Vampire. Right after Louis stops feeding on rats, he starts feeding on criminals and things, right? I think Lestat is just drinking from anyone he feels like, but Louis goes after criminals, I think.
He again starves himself to the point of almost oblivion, and then just lets his hunger take him, and he eats whoever he finds in the streets, really.
Because I think in the Lestat sequels, Lestat says once he's like become the rock star and things that he only feeds from criminals. So that's where they end up, which is so they sort of reject the non-human feeding and think it is better to feed from humans but not kill them, which we talk about this in relation to Discworld in the second part. But to me, that is a superior moral position in that no death is caused. Perhaps it would be better for them to feed on non-human animals but not kill them if you still want to maintain that hierarchy. But I think not killing humans is better than killing animals. But the reason why they don't feed on animals is like it's meant to be debasing, right? Like that's Lestat's whole thing is that you are debasing yourself. You are this apex predator and you're walking around, crawling around in the sewers, feeding on rats. But does it have a physical effect on their powers or anything like in the other books that we've seen?
Nothing on their powers.
Right. So it's
The
just
only
a
comment we get
dignity thing.
from Lestat is that rat's blood gets cold really quickly, and he doesn't like it cold.
Okay.
But the other interesting thing in Anne Rice's world, it's not just Louis or Lestat that feed on animal blood. In her world, it's actually introduced as something that is necessary in certain conditions. So one example that Lestat gives to Louis is, if traveling by ship, then you need to feast on rats that are on board in order to not cause a ruckus on the ship and have humans open up your coffin and stab you, and away you go. And that, again, is a really interesting innovation in Rice, and something that you don't see replicated. And we don't really see evidence of this, but Lestat introduces it as a kind of a universal concept or a universal action undertaken by all vampires when necessary. We don't, at least to the best of my knowledge, see that sort of wholesale uptake of the diet until, and again, it's the only example I can think of off the top of my head, Vampire Academy, where you get a whole class of vampires who subsist off feeders, who are humans that willingly donate their blood.
Oh, we definitely get examples of a willing feeder class before that. The one that jumps to mind is the Darren Shan books that we'll get to, but I think it might be implied somewhere in the Rice books that there is a class of feeders, perhaps with Akasha, the Queen of the Damned. I don't know.
I haven't read them. I probably should, but I just really don't like Anne Rice. I just find the whole, you can't turn a character like Lestat and then make him like a sympathetic rock star. That just rubs me the wrong way.
Oh, I think that completely follows.
No.
If he's Byron and Byron was alive in the 80s, Byron would be a rock star.
Yeah, but was Byron also a sadistic freak?
Yes. That daughter that he sent to the coven who died of malnourishment may have been the product of an incestuous relationship with his sister. Yeah. So I don't know if I'm
Bill.
getting the right or wrong daughter. No, Byron's a little fuck yeah. Byron's not a good dude. Yeah. So I think that tracks, but it is goofy, and it is made extra goofy by the horrible film adaptation. Although I just found out that they're doing a TV series of it.
Yeah, it drops really, really soon. I'm really excited to watch it. Unlike the Vampire Academy adaptation that drops, I think, 16th of September, they released the trailer for it this morning.
Yeah, no good.
My God, it's shocking. I don't know what it is, but people just don't seem to be able to adapt this book. If there's any Hollywood executives listening to this podcast, give me a call because I know what to do. I can fix this. I'm shooting my shot. Let me
Okay.
adapt Vampire Academy because no one seems to get it right.
Is it just like more lesbians? Is that the answer?
No, I don't think there is any same-sex relationships in this text.
Excuse me. The entire relationship between the main two characters?
No, they're best friends.
Yeah, okay, subtext, Sophie,
No.
subtext. The same way that Thingo isn't just her daughter.
No, have you? She's her love for Dimitri. She
Yeah.
saves him from being a Strigoi, and like he feeds on her and nearly kills her, and she still brings him back. She risks her life for a man that she's in love with, that she then marries and has babies with.
But
No.
the first half of that book is about how these two girls ran away together, and there's all the rumors about how they had to feed off each other to stay
Well,
alive
yeah.
while they were.
No, so the issue with the feeding is,
You don't think it's an analogy for sexuality?
no, see, that is such an overblown reading in vampire fiction, and it's not.
This vampire series that's about a young high school girl who has an awakening and starts to become involved in a love triangle between different vampires. You don't think it's a
Oh
metaphor for
God,
sexuality?
that is not the synopsis. The synopsis is, so it takes place at St. Vladimir's Academy, which is a school in Northwest. I'm pretty sure it's in the Northwest, or maybe it's the Northeast. No, it must be Northeast if they travel to Spokane. Yeah, it has to be Northwest. No, I'm not going through the synopsis.
You're telling me there's no sexual undertones to this story about two high school
No,
girls
because
running away together and becoming involved in a love triangle?
the bite releases endorphins like a drug, and the feeders are referred to as
What
drug
other
addicts.
acts release endorphins
No.
that you might start participating in as a
No,
teenager?
they're drug addicts. That's what it's supposed to be. And the issue is that you're called a blood whore if you're a dampier, so a half human, half vampire.
And what does whore imply?
Oh, Josh, no, there's no there. Seriously, there have been so many studies written about how heterosexual young adult fiction is. It's a real issue in like one of the main issues in young adult fiction. And this text gets brought up in those discussions. I'm sorry, you can't convince me that there's sex in it. They're best mates. They're best mates. There's one scene where they.
Best friends in high school
No.
never kiss.
So,
That's never happened.
oh God. So there's a scene where, so they share a telekinetic connection where she's literally in bed and then like connects to the other girl's mind where she's having sex with her partner and she like severs the connection. Surely, if this was going to be sexy time, she'd be partaking.
You don't think that if you had a crush on your best friend who was the same sex as you, and then you like got things of them having sex with the opposite sex, that that might be something you don't want to be involved in because you are very jealous and also not into
No, you'd watch. You'd be a voyeur. I reckon you'd be a voyeur. You'd
You
watch.
might be a voyeur. I might be a voyeur, but she's
Now,
not
because she likes men. Okay, this conversation's getting off track. Where were
voyeur.
we? Stop reading subtext into all my things.
I think you're kidding yourself with that one. Another book that gets brought up in sympathetic vampire movement of the 70s is Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough's Hotel Transylvania from 1978, which gets cited in, this is
I saw Shanice Lane. So she wrote Post Modern Vampires, which won the Lord Ruthven Award. It's a really good book. I don't agree with any of her readings because she's wrong.
Does she think Twilight and Vampire Academy are about sex?
No, so her argument, she looks at Interview with the Vampire. It's Tomic's argument from the 80s or the 90s where, Louis's androgynous and or trans and his diet is a reflection of his feminization that he expresses through anorexia and bulimia. So not
Oh, no,
only
thank
is
you.
it highly problematic, and I agree, it exists, but feminizing someone through an eating disorder, pretty fucked.
Yep. Also, going with my Byron Shelley analogy, Shelley was often malnourished, and
I like this reading. It's a historical reading. It brings in the introduction.
I mean, I think it suggests some intent on Rice's part, whereas that trans reading is certainly a like reader defined reading. So you said this is a really good book, but then have given lots of reasons why it is not. What is good about it?
So she examines vampire fiction. I think it's North American vampire fiction against presidencies.
Well, there was a book that did that about Batman that was pretty interesting
Yeah.
about how Batman changes to reflect a different
Exactly,
political.
exactly. I think it's just, although I don't agree with a lot of what she says, mainly because it's her reading of diet in these texts. Like in True Blood, she argues that the shift from, or the difference between Twilight and True Blood in, your animal blood drinking vamps and synthetic drinking vamps corresponds to the split between Republican and Democrats in America. But she doesn't quite flesh that out. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't like that reading. It's just well researched. It's well written. It's a survey, so she deals with a shit ton of texts. It's just a, it's a masterclass, I would argue.
I don't know. It sounds like it sucks, actually.
I really like it.
Except disagree with everything it
No,
says.
she's a woman, scholar. I'm sick of citing old white
Got it. I shouldn't have a job. I get it.
dudes.
So, all of that is to say that Saint-Germain is often cited as a central figure in the sympathization of vampires that happened in the 70s, and is regularly cited as a vegetarian vampire, though, as you and I have both read the book, and he is not. Yeah, he feeds on the women he has sex with until he turns them into vampires, at which point he is no longer attracted to them, which subtext, because they've been soiled. Yeah, this is a virgin mother crone energy cycle thing.
I just found it so boring.
It's very boring, except for the satanic orgy.
No, all of the female mutilation and sodomization just it gave, I told you, it gave me nightmares, this text. It just
Oh,
really
okay.
put me off. And Keira Knightley just looks so hot and she's the vampire king
This
in
is
it.
true.
It's such a good movie. But I digress.
You sure do. But I think you put in here that the how are we saying this? Niflheim.
Yeah. So she seems to think that he's a vegetarian vampire.
Well, I'm reading the quote here.
Yeah.
Saint-Germain's vampire body poses no threat to the women in the novel. While his reluctance to feed is similar to Louis's constant hunger throughout Interview with the Vampire, animal blood is an adequate substitute. Okay. It is Saint-Germain's embarrassment at this prerequisite that draws our attention to his feeding needs, unlike the psychological disturbances that haunt Rice's Louis or Romero's Mutt. So, yes, I think there might be some sentence structure confusing. Oh, no, because it is. It's saying animal blood is an adequate substitute for Saint-Germain, but it's not an adequate substitute for Louis, which that is not correct because he doesn't, at least in the first book, he doesn't eat or drink animal blood. But I sort of got from that second part, it is Saint-Germain's embarrassment at this prerequisite that draws our attention to his feeding needs, because the feeding on the women is part of the romantic thing in Hotel Transylvania. So it was sort of recasting that as a desirable thing where he says, hey, look, this is the thing I need, but you're into it, so let's get together. Whereas in Interview with the Vampire, the idea of feeding on people is still like horrific. There's somewhat of a transition there. But yeah, you're right. This seems to be another example of citing Saint-Germain as a vegetarian vampire, which maybe he becomes in the later books, but certainly not in the first one, which is the influential one,
What she's getting at, which I forgot to mention
I
before, is
think.
Louis does find animal blood to be insufficient insofar as it causes him pain. So he experiences, by virtue of drinking animal blood, that he's able to form closer attachments and love humankind and care for humans. But that closeness causes him anguish, to the point where Lestat says to him, you won't care anymore. You'll become numb to human suffering and love if you drink human blood, which is what happens. And he kind of flips a switch and then he's like, wait.
Oh, well, yeah, no. So, Interview with the Vampire and the Vampire Chronicles books have this idea of feeding but not killing. And then in Hotel Transylvania and the Saint-Germain books, we have this idea of voluntary feeding, which is another sort of subset or strain of the vegetarian vampire tradition. I mean, this is, they are explicitly not vegetarian or human abstinent, because, but again, drinking without killing, I don't know how we'd categorize this. It's certainly part of.
I would say it's a more moral and ethical way of feeding on humans, but it's also worth noting that these voluntary situations are usually romantic situations. So it's a vampire feeding on his human partner. And usually in these texts,
Which definitely doesn't happen in Vampire Academy.
no, it does not happen. There's no feeding on humans in that unless you're one of the bad guys.
It's the two ladies that run a goe together. She sustains herself by feeding on the
She's
human.
half human, half vampire.
Is she?
Yep.
She's half vampire?
Yep. So they're Daphne is. And then so they're protectors of the vampires because they're strong and don't get burnt by the sunlight because they're half human and they eat human food. But yeah, so I would argue that the voluntary feeding is a romantic development, and as you noted earlier, it's that conflation of eating and sex, or drinking blood more accurately, and sex that we see across vampire. It's everywhere.
Dracula, at least, and Varney and Ruthven.
Yeah, it's because the bite is phallic. It's the piercing of the skin. The sucking. So you've got fellatio slash lingus.
I loved Phallic Bites' first album, but their later stuff was not so
But
much.
yeah, it's super sexy, super arousing, supposedly for the people, except Vampire Academy. I think it, I'm not sure, it just becomes like another form of penetration. But then you do get more problematic aspects in True Blood, where Bill, or Southern Vampire Mysteries, I should say, where Bill's like, I must bite you before I ejaculate, or it won't be as nice for me. It's just like,
Yeah, but then he fingers her with his vampire blood
And
and
then
it's all
heals
good,
her.
right?
Yeah.
That wow. Okay. We'll get to that. That's
We'll
episode
get to
three.
that.
So apart from the films, we do get some vampire development in the early half of the 20th century is in comics and horror comics. I'm not too familiar with these. At some point I will go and hunt down all the old vampire horror comics and read through them all. Have not done that yet, and I'm probably not going to do it for a while. One I have attempted to read is Vampirella, which does come quite a bit later. I think it's 1969 that comes out, so we've had some developments earlier that we'll get to. I've seen this cited in a couple of places as there eventually being like a blood substitute serum, so like a synthetic blood thing. I've read the first three volumes, I think, of Vampirella out of seven or eight, and I haven't come across this yet. So maybe it's in there. I cannot confirm. But apparently, also as she starts off again like sort of a villain character, and then apparently becomes more heroic as it goes on. And then again, I've read that as she becomes more heroic, there is a point where she only feeds on the villains. So again, we have this line between the types of people it's okay to feed on, which comes into Interview with the Vampire and things like that. So I cannot confirm any of that. What I can confirm is the premise of Vampirella, which is fucking wild. Because Vampirella, who is introduced in a blood shower, like the first panel you get of Vampirella is her naked in a steamy shower of blood.
Oh my.
I was like, okay, this is the sexy vampire comic. Like, how hardcore is it going to be? And then that is the first panel is her like thrusting her breasts out in a shower, going, "Ooh, blood," or whatever. It's a lot. And I was like, okay. But Vampirella is quite fun. It's pretty campy and it has some cool ideas, including the one that Vampirella is not a vampire as we would think of her. She is an alien vampire from a blood planet. Her whole thing, which is meant to be a joke, but she is from a planet where everything that is water is blood. So H2O rather than being hydrogen and oxygen is hemoglobin and oxygen. I don't know if that really works, but that is the joke that they make. There's some good jokes. She fights. She does drac karate. Which is a much better
God.
written pun than one said out loud. So
Oh
that's the
yeah.
kind of tone of Vampirella.
Yeah, I just did a Google and gosh, they don't have her wearing much, do they?
They sure don't, and she contorts in some very interesting ways.
Oh my gosh, it must be a quite a warm planet she inhabits.
That's true. Well, if there's blood everywhere, it's probably got natural body temperature. So if you Google Vampirella shower, it'd be.
What am I going to say? Oh, I've got what appears to be a R18 plus website offering Vampirella
Oh wow, okay.
shower videos.
Hang on, this one here.
Okay.
Yeah, you've just seen it.
I'm seeing shower curtain image.
Yeah, this is
Oh
the
my God.
introductory Vampirella panel, where you'll notice this panel here where the shower is going directly onto her breasts. So that is how she is introduced.
Wow. I wish I enjoyed my showers that much.
She looks like she's having a good time. But this then sort of adds another conundrum to the thing where Vampirella, she's a different species. She's from a different planet. So, like, she's a different food chain. But also, on her world, is she a vegetarian if she is effectively just drinking water? Like, she's not feeding on the creatures of this planet. She is drinking the natural blood that is produced. Where does that fit in?
I would say if it's not coming from a species, then it would be vegan or vegetarian. Because if it would just be like drinking, if it's the equivalent of water, then I would say she's a vegan. Because again, it has no biomaterial. It's a naturally occurring resource, as opposed to, although I guess you could also say blood's a naturally occurring resource in human bodies.
It's like it's non
Yeah, it's not.
non-biological, or
Yeah.
if it's biological, it's not, it's non-animal.
So does she get, she comes to Earth at some stage, or is it all set on this alien planet?
It's not clear. At some point, she starts interacting with humans, but are they space people who have crash landed on her planet? And then sometimes she is in like gothic setting. Sometimes she's in science fiction setting. It's like, yeah, science fiction, fantasy, gothic thing. And they start off as sort of separate short stories that I think the coherent narrative gets developed later on. I don't think they're meant to be taken seriously, but I think they've hit upon some interesting ideas there. And of course, Vampirella, yes, very influential. So that is Vampirella. But similarly, we get some interesting developments, particularly in the ways of vegetarian vampire related things in comics and in a lot of 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s children's media. A famous example is the Count Chocula cereal, which came out in 1971 with the tagline, "I want to eat your cereal." It was part of a Monster cereals line of breakfast cereals. It was produced all up until 2010. It was like, yeah, marketed through this idea of these, they're monsters, they're trying to eat the cereal. So again, is he actually a vegetarian vampire who can eat other things rather than drink human blood? But also the premise of the advertising for this was that the monsters that were the mascots were scared of the children, right? It was the children that were coming to eat them. I mean, part of my general understanding or my hypothesis about the vegetarian vampire is that it is just a necessary step as vampires become more friendly and more integrated in human society. We can't have them eating on us, so it is necessary to find alternative diets for them. So here we see that in the children's cereal advertising, where they are made more sympathetic by eating differently and actually being again cast in sort of the prey role. Again, this is just a silly children's ad, but Sophie, you had a link to this and a broader cereal movement, for want of a better term.
The key point is that there was a figure called James Kellogg who created the first health sanitarium in America around, when would it have been? I want to say 1870s. And he was the first or one of the first people to mass manufacture cereal. And I always thought, you know, I see James Kellogg and I think of Kellogg's here. There's no relation between the
Really?
two.
Wow. Okay.
No, it's
Because
really
I'm like, you're burying
unfortunate.
the lead here, Sophie.
I know. There is no connection. I desperately tried to prove it and I couldn't.
Okay.
But obviously at the time, well, the gist of what Kellogg was saying is, you know, it, for breakfast, people would usually eat meat, breakfast meats. And so he created cereal as a vegetarian alternative, for breakfast food. And this, you know, owes back to, the Christian Bible, vegetarians in the early 1800s. You've also got whoever founded vegetarianism in America. I can't think of their name, but they created like a vegetarian colony in Philadelphia where they ate oats and only drank water and that, you know, they had cold showers and they weren't allowed to drink alcohol or masturbate, you know, nothing to get the
Hey,
blood
what?
boiling. I can't think of what they were. Yeah, the Battle Creek Sanitarium.
Right.
All right. So, yes. Yeah, so the Battle Creek Sanitarium was a world-renowned health resort in Battle Creek, Michigan. And it started in 1866 on health principles advocated by the Seventh-day Adventist Church and was managed by John Harvey Kellogg. So people essentially came here. It was one of the first, you know, wellness destinations where people who, you know, stayed there were given a vegetarian diet and, you know, different temperate baths to do God knows what to your body. But I always thought, at least to me, that, you know, there might not be anything in that connection, but I thought it was interesting that you have a vegetarian vampire of sorts who wants to eat your cereal, as the tagline of the box says, when, you know, 100 years earlier, you did have breakfast cereal emerging as connected to vegetarianism before, you know, breakfast cereals became popular mainstays.
That's very interesting because, yes, of course, like the traditional English breakfast is like bacon, eggs, sausage, right? All that. So, the same year as the Count Chocula cereal line is launched in 1971, we have the character Vincent the Vegetable Vampire, played by Morgan Freeman, on the children's entertainment program, The Electric Company. This is one of the funniest things I have ever seen. This is Morgan Freeman, a very young Morgan Freeman from 1971, walking through a vegetable shop while dressed as a, campy Dracula in the opera cloak and everything, singing about how he loves, how he's Vincent the Vegetarian Vampire and he just loves to eat vegetables.
Vincent, the vegetable vampire. In the night time when tomatoes start to scream, it's only Vincent, the vegetable vampire, creeping in the garden of your dream.
Again, another children's media where a vampire is made non-threatening by changing his diet and being an actual vegetarian vampire. And of course, so the Electric Company was produced by Children's Television Workshop, which is the same company that also produced Sesame Street, which started a few years earlier in 1969, which is, of course, awesome. And I think one of my favorite Sesame Street characters growing up and probably still now is Count Von Count, who there are lots of online debates about whether he is actually a vampire or not.
Of course he is. Look at the fangs on him.
Well, this is the thing. We never actually see him feed.
They've dressed him up. He's got widow's peaks. He's definitely a vampire.
Well, he's vampire presenting.
Yeah. He's got the accent. Not unlike, is it Doreen in Discworld?
Yeah. I mean, he's a parody of Bela Lugosi. And it took me a while to realize that, like, it was a pun on Count. Like, I don't think I got that until relatively recently, I'm ashamed to say.
Well, all he does is count.
Yeah. But I didn't get the connection to, like, and it's Count Von Count. I was like, yeah. It's just funny because the words are the same, but I didn't actually like get that was the joke until probably post PhD. So I don't know, we cannot confirm nor deny whether the Count is a vegetarian vampire or not, but he is another example of vampires being presented as non-threatening and friendly. And I think it's significant that we don't see him feed. But also I just want to point him out because something else I also realized recently is that he is the reason why all the vampires in Discworld are obsessed with counting things. That is one of their traits, and they make good bankers and can do math sums very quickly.
Yeah.
I never really understood what that was. And then like, I think putting this together, I was like, Sesame Street. I think I've found there's like one other example I've come across, the sequel to Dracula 2000, which is not Dracula 3000. That is a completely different movie. Dracula 2000 sequel, which is about like a kung fu monk who tracks down Dracula, who's reincarnated and has been held hostage in a basement by a bunch of guys who want to use his blood to become immortal. It's called Dracula 2 Ascension from 2003. But one of the ways they keep the kidnapped Dracula, who looks very Spike-like in this film, one of the ways they keep him trapped and occupied is they spill a bag of beans on the floor and so that he can't step over them until he counts them all. But then, of course, the reveal when he escapes, they're like, but you can't cross the beans because you need to count them all. And then he's like, there are 2,300, and he just says it because he can count really quickly. So that is the only other reference I've come across of vampires being obsessive counters, but that seems to trace back to Sesame Street and just be a pun on the term count. Another notable kids vampire character, children's vampire character that gets mentioned a lot in vegetarian vampire literature is Bunnicula from 1979. That's when the first book was published. I think it becomes a cartoon series in the 80s as well. So he sucks the life force from vegetables.
Interesting.
He's not actually eating the vegetables, but I'd say we could claim this is like an actual vegetarian vampire as well. Though I think notably here, this is the first non-human vampire apart from alien vampires that we've come across, right? Something else about Bunnicula is that he is
a rabbit.
So a herbivorous animal.
Oh.
Which is again repeated in the 1988 cartoon Count Duckula,
which is a British animated comedy horror television series from 1988 to 1993, in which Count Duckula, as the theme song states, won't bite beast or man because he's a vegetarian.
In the heart of Transylvania, in the vampire hall.
N.
And like Binocula before him, Count Duckula also feeds on carrot and other
Yeah,
veggies.
I think in the opening animation where the theme song's playing, he's sucking a broccoli.
Yeah.
So, and this is, I think, been cited in a few places as the first use of the term vegetarian rather than Twilight. But as you discovered, there is an earlier instance in the Vegetarian Times magazine.
So from memory, it is a panel lifted from the 1981 Vegetarian Times April edition. And the Vegetarian Times was a vegetarian magazine of sorts. It was also a bit of a newsletter. It was kind of an amalgamation of the two that always promoted vegetarian brands. It also had interviews with famous vegetarians. Anywho, I found this particular comic strip. It was an image of a vampire father and mother, and the vampire looked, of course, like Dracula with the widow's peaks and the big schnoz and all of that. And it's a son eating a vampire child. So their son sitting at his desk, reading a book or studying, and he's munching on a carrot.
There's an apple there as well.
There is an apple. And there's a bin with what looks to be more fruit and veg kind of in there. And the father's kind of exclaiming to what looks like to be a very pissed off mother, "Where did we go wrong? Our son, a vegetarian." And this was, I guess it's the first time we see the use of vegetarian, as Josh said, applied to a vampire. But again, in this specific case, it's not a vegetarian vampire, as we like to think of it, as a vampire who no longer feeds on human blood. But in this case, a vampire who is eating vegetables.
This is an actual vegetarian vampire.
An actual vegetarian vampire in our human understanding of the term vegetarian.
Yeah, there is a long-standing tradition of actual vegetarian vampires, or at least non-animal consuming vampires in children's media, which is that carries through all the way to things like Adventure Time, right? The cartoon series that starts in 2010, where we have Marceline the Vampire Queen, who drinks the color red, which I guess also technically makes her a vegetarian. I've never thought about the ethics of drinking colors. But yeah, this is something that begins in the 70s and carries through to the modern day of vampires being made friendlier for children's media, and a crucial part of that is explaining away their diet. And it's also a place where we get examples of actual vegetarian vampires rather than vampires who just eat other animals. So yeah, we have this idea of voluntary feeding, which in these early examples is tied up with romanticism. I think later we get some of these for cattle dystopia leaning arrangements. But another way of solving the vampire's biological need for blood is through donated blood through blood bags. Has become a common feature of modern vampire media. And I think that the earliest example I can find of this happening is the 1959 movie First Man into Space, which is about an astronaut. I mean, he's the first man who goes into space, but the radiation sort of mutates him, and he comes back to Earth and he's sort of turned into a vampire, or he needs blood. It's not really explained why. He just radiation, now he's a vampire who looks like a weird stone carpet man. But there's a scene in that movie where he breaks into a blood bank, and it is like this sort of sympathetic interview with the vampire thing, where he is grappling with this need and everyone's treating him like a monster and he's trying to find ways around it, and he has this big speech at the end of the film. So that's the earliest example I can find, not a particularly significant or influential one, I don't think. Do you know of anything earlier than that?
No.
Another earlier one that still comes like 14 years after First Man into Space is the film Gunja and Hess from 1973. The main character in that, Gunja, I think he's a doctor, or he's a university professor, historian, but he has access to a medical lab. There is a scene of him taking home blood bags, but we never actually see him feed on them, and then he just ends up abducting and murdering people. So it's sort of like he tried that, it didn't work, is the implication. So this idea is being brought up, but then rejected. And I think that also happens in the First Man into Space, where like he takes the blood bags, but then he goes on a rampage anyway. So we're getting gestures towards this as like a possible alternative, but not an effective one. Another one that gets cited a lot as being, I think, the first literary example of the blood bag is Susie McKee Charnas's Vampire Tapestry from 1980. where the main vampire in that is not a vegetarian vampire at all.
No, he's asked when he's captive, you know, what about blood banks? Your food is commercially available, so why all the complication and danger of the hunt? And Dr. Wayland, who's a vampire, responds and says, I prefer to keep the mechanics of my survival firmly in my own hand. I can't afford to lose my hunting skills. So he really revels in the hunt.
Yeah, to end that quote, there is in 200 years, there may be no blood banks, but I will still need my food. Mm. Which is an interesting take on it, going, yes, I am immortal, so I can't just assume this will be around forever. But that's assuming there will be people around in 200 years.
You could also, again, there's an environmental subtext there. When's this written?
Published in 1980.
So you've got, in the 80s and the 70s, there was huge environmental pushes. And that's Thomas Fahey's whole argument that the 80s were a time of environmental crisis, worsening environmental degradation, and you see a lot of eco-criticism through vampire texts at the time.
Yeah, although he rejects the idea of feeding off blood banks and donated blood, we do actually have him feeding on it when, he is imprisoned. He's captives who are like, they're like the mafia or something. They're like these mob dudes.
He's caged. He's genuinely in a cage with a cop being treated like an animal.
But the way they feed him there is by bringing him IV bags. Mm-hmm. So whether it's voluntary or not, this does seem to be the first literary example of a vampire feeding off IV bags.
But again, and I was thinking this when you mentioned it with Ganja and Tet, so we have both texts, or all three now, have shown it to be a viable option, yet each of the vampires in these stories have still said no and turned their back on it.
Well, I think the first two show it as a not a viable option, or suggest it's not, whereas here it's like, rather than a biological rejection of it, it is a philosophical one. He's saying, I could do that, but I won't. Mm. But yeah, donated blood becomes like sort of a staple of vampire films going forward. Notable example that I've written down there is Only Lovers Left Alive, where they sustain themselves off donated blood taken from hospitals, though of course that film does end with them turning on the person in the street. You like Only Lovers Left Alive. I do not. So why don't
that's
you talk
a fantastic
about it?
Film.
I can't believe you think that's fantastic, but Anne Rice is boring.
The soundtrack is just beautiful. And Tilda Swinton, like, she is a vampire. She has to be a vampire.
I don't know if I like Tilda Swinton or not.
I love her. So vampires drink donated blood from the hospital because human blood is now too polluted and toxic due to pollution, climate change, and so on. So, and you see it in the film, one of the characters bites a human and dies because our blood is now toxic to vampires.
So this is interesting because of the connection to climate change, because otherwise this is a fairly straightforward like AIDS analogy. Do they ever explain how climate change pollutes human blood? Because that doesn't make intuitive sense
they
to me.
They do. I don't have the quote, and it's been some time since I watched it, but the Tilda Swinton character does note that, you know, the air quality has worsened, the water supplies are toxic. There's a point where, and this ties into Anna Singh's book about mushrooms and climate change, that, you know, Tilda Swinton, I think it's in her driveway, she sees like a mushroom growing and proceeds to soliloquize at length that, you know, the way in which mankind's destroying the planet. And it's here the setting becomes important. It's set in Detroit, where, of course, you know, all the big motor companies used to manufacture their cars, and now it's a bit of a, you know, urban dump.
See, all of this sounds way cooler than the movie that I watched. And it's because when you said she starts soliloquizing, I'm like, oh, yes, this is the movie where, you know, the meme about people who use subtext are cowards. This is that movie where she's constantly like turning to the camera and going, and that is why we are very, very lonely.
No.
Like, well, what's the thing? What's they had their nickname for each other? What do they call each other?
I don't remember.
There's something where it's just like, yes, I get it.
It's just such a fantastic.
It's very
slow. I've got the sound in my head.
The blurb for that movie that you get on like Netflix or whatever, it says, oh, there's these two vampires, they're growing old and disillusioned, but then his younger sister comes to town to shake things up.
Yeah,
and that is
super irritating.
One 10-minute scene in this like 2.5-hour movie, but that is in the blurb because that is the only thing that fucking happens in this film. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just sad guitar.
That's cool. You've got like Christopher Marlowe as one of the characters, and they're called Adam and Eve.
I wouldn't call that cool.
I think it's a fantastic.
I am the odd one out here. Like, this is a very revered movie, but it is so boring. And I think, like, to actually watch, I think there's some cool ideas there, but I became very frustrated at, like, yes, the constant monologuing to camera. that happens in it. I'm like, can we have some subtlety? Mm.
I see both sides. I definitely didn't adore it watching it for entertainment purposes, but I found it rich.
This is like that book that's really good, but you disagree with all of it. You're like, this movie's great. I didn't enjoy watching it.
It could be an academic thing, but I find like Dracula as a text boring as batshit. I hate Dracula for the purposes of entertainment. If I read it, I'm bored. But if I'm analyzing it, like the book bloody comes to life.
This is true. Dracula, like the pacing of it is a real problem.
It's such a slog. I remember reading it the first time and going, fuck, I thought this was like it's the vampire text. This is going to be so dope. And then I was like, oh God.
It's like the whole middle section. The start is like really fun and exciting, and then they go back to London and it just drags, and then there's like a big hunt at the end, but that whole middle section is very slow.
I disagree. The hunt is over in like 30 seconds. It's so disappointing. And like the end line, he like vanishes with a smile. I was like, oh fuck off, he's not smiling when he's been stabbed. I don't like that ending. But no, like, and that same thing with Only Lovers Left Alive. If I'm watching it for just pure enjoyment or entertainment, don't love it so much. Like, it's not, you know, a text that I'll, or a movie I'll go back.
It's no Underworld Bloodlines. That's yeah, what I'm saying.
But when you're analyzing it, and it also has such a dreamy soundtrack, and I really like soundtracks. So if your film has a good soundtrack, it's already got a, you know, an A marking in my books.
Okay.
Another example of donated blood is Kim Newman's Anno Dracula series, which is sort of a long-running vampire alternative history series that begins in 1992. But yes, the vampires in that book, although they are like tyrant rulers and things, they're not like good dudes, but the way they do subsist economically is by donated blood. So yes, this is an example of where there is a class of people who donate blood. I'm not going to say voluntarily, because I think it is just they're like child prostitutes that they feed off. So not voluntary, but somewhere in between the cattle dystopia and a voluntary underclass.
So that's donated blood.
Not all the donated blood, though.
Not all of it, but some examples. We then have two films from the 1980s. From 1987, we have My Best Friend is a Vampire and A Return to Salem's Lot. So I haven't seen this, but you have?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay.
Just from what Sir Thomas Fahey wrote a book, Dining with Madmen, Fat Food and the Environment in 1980s Horror. So this piqued my interest because of the interest in vampire feeding habit and the connection Fahey draws between a shift in diet and environmentalism as a whole, which he discussed both My Best Friend is a Vampire and A Return to Salem's Lot and treated them quite closely. And what interests me is that in My Best Friend is a Vampire, you get a vegetarian vampire who feeds on big pig's blood purchased from the butcher. I think it's just, you know, an overarching interest now and passion for vegetarian vampires that when I hear of these examples, I just want to watch them to understand them and see how they fit into my knowledge overall.
Well, the pig's blood being bought from the butchers is interesting because I don't think we've had an earlier example of that popping up. And also that's what happens in Discworld, as we discuss in the next episode.
And it's also what happens in Buffy. And we do see the purchasing of blood from a kosher butcher in The Mortal Instruments as well. So it seems to be a recurring theme that, you know, perhaps this is where it opens up that avenue of blood where it's no longer just your options of donated blood, synthetic blood or animal blood. But now you add to that animal blood purchased from the butcher, which I think is pretty cool. Also really gross. Yes. I don't like the butchers. Fahey's whole argument is that in the 1980s with the rise of fad diets, you have all like, you know, the Jane Fonda exercise videos coming out. You have the Atkins diet starting. You also get the emergence of gym franchises in America, that in horror films, vampires take on this aspirational diet culture, dietary habits. And My Best Friend is a Vampire, according to Fahey, is a prime example of this, of choosing right healthy foods. So one of the blood drinks has a label on it that says, and I quote, natural, no additives, preservatives, salts, starches, yeast, sugars, or flavor enhancers. Keep refrigerated, low fat, no MSG. And then there's clearly in this film also some sort of vampire food production company because there are other items in the vampire's pantry, including a pig's blood soda, pig's blood light. And Fahey goes on to say that in this film, it appears that vampires worry about the dangers of processed foods, just like humans. Like the butcher's hat, which reminds customers about the poor quality of processed meat in America, these vampire products promise beverages without sugar, preservatives, or flavor enhancers. So it sounds really cool. It sounds to me to be kind of a precursor to the Southern Vampire Mysteries and True Blood, where you have this rise of branded vampire consumables like True Blood, or as we'll see later in the next podcast in Love at Stake, where we have, you know, Choco Blood, Blisky, Bleer. It's just fun.
Okay, so we also have a Return to Salem's Lot from 1987, which I'm assuming is an unofficial sequel to Stephen King's Salem's Lot, which I think the TV movie comes out in the 70s. So yes, Salem's Lot is another big part of 20th century vampire stuff. Doesn't really do anything that original with vampires. It's just the fact that Stephen King is talking about them. But I have in the works an entire article about the representation of vampires in Stephen King, because I discovered from having read, I think it's 40 of his books over the last 6 months or so, Stephen King thinks everything is a vampire. All his monsters are vampires. He calls the clown from It a vampire. And normally they're energy vampires, like that feed off fear and things. So I have a whole article in me about that I've tentatively started. What's interesting in terms of vegetarian vampire stuff is one of his more recent books, The Outsider, from 2018, my 46th favorite Stephen King book. So this is in the bottom six. There's actually, I've read 50 of them, not 40. But yes, in The Outsider, which is just a rehash of books he's done earlier, like it's The Dark Half and Desperation again, where there's like a monster that infects a town and can shapeshift into different people.
Nice.
Stephen King describes him as a vampire, and the end confrontation with this creature, the Outsider, at the end of the book, which the Outsider is also what Lahala from the 19th century translates as, and is a word Lovecraft used, so that we have a bit of a vampire lineage there. But the Outsider stops and has a conversation with the guys who are hunting it down, and they're like, hey, Outsider, you suck, because you come into our town and you eat all our people, and it's no good. And the Outsider turns around and goes, well, what is the difference between me doing that and you eating meat? I need to feed, you need to feed, what's the difference? Ooh. So actually addressing the ethics of eating tradition there. And then the people in The Outsider respond that, well, okay, fine, but we don't sexually violate the animals that we eat like you have, because he's also like a weird pedophile monster. Now, that's a bit dubious, because I think vegans would point out that you definitely do, and there's forced inseminations in meat production and all of that. But I guess they're saying, well, we're not doing it for sexual pleasure, right? It is just this feeding necessity, to which the Outsider points out, like, well, yeah, but what about veal, though? Like, if you're calling me a pedophile, why have you got this thing called veal? Like, that is unnecessary. That is just a pleasure preference. I thought that was interesting to see Stephen King putting that in his book, given how popular he is and how prominent vampires are within his fiction. That entire conversation, though, is cut out of the TV adaptation, where they just go, you're a monster, and he's like, bah! So any subtlety or nuance or engagement there is cut out. But more of that in my article when I get around to writing it, which isn't by Stephen King, but is building off his works, seems to be explicitly engaging with vegetarianism and the ethics of eating. Do you want to step us through this one as well?
So again, I haven't watched this one, but again, and I'm quoting from Thomas Fahey's The Vampires, cattle taking only what they need. And this in the novel is contrasted by the vampires. To humans, where they say, we're all dairy farmers in these parts. You outsiders grow stock for meat. We grow them for blood. The human blood is still the best, but the way things are going nowadays, it's not quite good enough for you. What with drugs, alcohol, hepatitis, and this AIDS virus going around. So you have in this instance, vampires are farming and raising cattle and selling their milk off for profit, but they're also feeding on the cows for blood. And the reasoning provided, as I noted before, is due to, I guess, what's seen as the pollution and the quality of human blood due to drugs, alcohol, hepatitis, and AIDS, keeping in mind the emergence of the AIDS virus in the early 1980s. So it's an interesting example, I guess, that looks towards Only Lovers Left Alive, which we mentioned earlier, but came out in 2013, where there's this idea now of human blood being polluted or toxic, and therefore vampires, or the shift away from human blood is not due to, you know, ethics or morality or care for humankind or love for humankind, but due to the fact that, you know, we're riddling our bodies with unsavory materials that pollute and muddy our blood. So we no longer, I assume, you no longer taste as good, but it's also toxic. So it's that idea of clean eating that Fahey discusses and is interested in.
It's interesting that this isn't a human cattle dystopia. This is like a cattle dystopia that they are imitating rather than imposing cattle farming on people, on humans. They are just imitating what humans do. And I guess, you know, asking the question, unlike Stephen King, who the I know authors who don't use subtext meme is based on, rather than having the creatures turn to the camera and say, yes, but it's a no-like feel, we actually have an exploration of that. So then, what is better? Do you want vampires farming sheep, or would you partake of the meat beast? Which of these is more ethical?
Well, there's two ideas. So I think subsisting on donated blood taken from hospitals is the best way to go, because you're not killing anyone or anything. Synthetic blood also fits on my scale there. And again, this is because I hate humankind and we're destroying the planet. I think the best way would be for vampires to revert to feeding on us and just doing a bit of a Thanos, you know, just wipe out half the population.
So what you really want is for the meat beast to eat us.
We're the meat beast.
That's really obvious now, but of course, the, you know, we are the meat beast for vampires, and that they can feed from us and we regenerate, and perhaps it doesn't taste good. Okay. I think I'm pro-meat beast. Maybe number two after synthetic blood, but I think it's preferable to donated blood, because sometimes donating blood hurts. The meat beast, they don't feel no pain.
Yeah, but no.
Yeah, but nah. All right, we will come back to this.
Another feeding alternative that sort of has its origins in the 1980s is synthetic blood, which now we're sort of muddying the definition of vegetarian here. Because donated blood is still taken from humans. Synthetic blood is not. So the earliest example I can find of synthetic blood is Game of Thrones author George R. R. Martin's 1982 novel Fever Dream, which is about an alchemist vampire king who like cements his power as the lord of all vampires by developing a blood substitute. Also, as I discussed in the Carpe Jugulum episode there, this is very explicitly tied to Byron and Shelley. The characters read and quote Byron throughout and name themselves and their boats after Byron and Shelley poems. So we're getting that tradition coming through there. But yeah, I'm shocked that is sort of the earliest one. You don't know of anything earlier than this? Because we also get the year after in 1983, we get Alan Moore, comic artist who does Watchmen and V for Vendetta and all of that. He's the big comics guy. He has a comic strip called The Beau Jeffrey Saga, which is about a bunch of like sort of like an Addams Family deal, about these monstrous people who live together in a house. And there is a vampire character in that called Uncle Fester, so a direct parody of Uncle Fester from the Addams Family. But he drinks soy blood, which again is intended comedically, but and I don't know how soy blood works, but this is actually like associating blood abstinent vampires with vegetarianism and veganism in this case. But more importantly, in 1983, we get what I think is one of the most profoundly influential works of vampire fiction, and perhaps the beginning of the synth blood trend, Hayuki Kikuchi's Vampire Hunter D, the first novel of which is published in 1983, gets a very influential anime adaptation, I think, in 1985. And then there is a whole series of these books and comic adaptations and things. So I think there's a lot of things about Vampire Hunter D, which is about a half vampire, a dampire. Here is the D is implied to be Dracula. He is the son of Dracula and Mina Harker. That is implied all throughout the books. But this is set like thousands of years in the future, where all the vampires have come out of hiding. They took over the world after there was like a nuclear holocaust that killed off all the people. They emerged and used their thousands of years of science knowledge to like rebuild society in their image. And the way they maintain control is they biologically engineered a whole bunch of monsters based on human legends and fairy tales, because of like psychological reasons, to scare all the people so that people would be scared of vampires and not oppose them. But then I think the people did rise up, and then all the vampires fucked off into space, except for the bad ones that they left on the earth, which are now hunted by vampire hunters. The best vampire hunter is Vampire Hunter D, who is the son of Dracula and rides a robot horse and is a cowboy samurai and is fucking cool. And also, this book just talks about how hot he is. Like, anytime there is a description of him, it's just the handsome youth. And oh, he was so handsome. And then I think one of the books, I think it's the third or the fourth one, literally has a line where it's like, women wanted him and men wanted to be him, but also sometimes to be with him as well. There is a thing about how he has a sexual appeal control over men as well that they have to resist. I think the first book is actually written really well. It has this sort of like it's very goofy and silly, but it has this sort of like oral narration to it and these interjections from the narrator. It's sort of told as this like legend that I think is really interesting. And then that is dropped from the rest of the series, which I'm also reading in translation because these are originally written in Japanese. So I don't know how much of this is the original writing, but fuck, some of the writing in these later books is very, very bad and extremely sexist. Every single one of these books is Vampire Hunter D shows up to town. There is an underage girl who offers herself to him in exchange for his services. He resists it, but she really wants it. And then that happens over and over and over again. So yeah, not cool. But anyway, this is all to say that it is established in the first of these books that the vampires have developed synthetic blood. This is not alchemy. This is explicitly science. It doesn't go into the description of the mechanics, but this is like worldwide. The vampires like stopped being a threat to humans because they stopped drinking blood because they could substitute it scientifically. And then I haven't got through the series because there's like 30 or 40 books or something, all of pretty poor quality. None of them have stood up to the first one so far. I have got 5 books in, and I was all but ready to give up on the series when I came across the following passage in book 5. This was like, I'm going to give it one more chapter and then I think I'm out. And then we had this. So do I want to read this whole thing? Let's go for it. After Dee galloped over a mile in under 5 minutes, because he's so cool, a vast ranch suddenly appeared. Out on the rich pasture, there was a herd of meat beasts, several of whom were munching the grass. 7 feet long and easily in excess of 1,500 pounds each, the barrel-shaped beasts were covered with armor-like plates that could deflect lasers. Their snouts were reminiscent of power shovels, with a pair of curved buckets, which were actually their upper and lower jaws, loaded with massive molars. Yet despite their daunting appearance, nothing tastier had ever graced a dinner table. Though the aesthetic sensibilities of the nobility as vampires, had given shape to many ghastly creatures for the sole purpose of terrifying humanity, these beasts were perhaps the greatest exception to that rule in that they also provided food. What's more, so long as the beast wasn't fatally wounded, the flesh that had been carved from it would begin growing back 12 hours later, while the creature itself felt no pain at all and offered no resistance. It was said that with a pair of these treasured beasts, a family of 5 would never go hungry. Unfortunately, these meat beasts were extremely limited in number, and they rarely produced offspring. Usually, if someone found one, they'd have a creature that could fetch them enough money to buy one of the nobility's flying machines, and that's usually what they did rather than keep them for food. I would keep the infinite food animal, personally. Oh, yeah. So here we have vampires. They've developed synthetic blood for themselves, but they have also biologically engineered a meat creature to give to humanity so that they can just eat meat forever, which on one hand reinforces the idea that people should eat meat. But it's explicitly said these creatures, they feel no pain. The meat grows back. This is essentially a victimless arrangement. I mean, the creatures are still being commodified in that they're treated as commodities that are bought and sold. So there's issues there. But I don't know. This is an interesting one. You got a take on this?
I just like a picture of what the meat beasts are like.
I'm thinking like a big long hippo. That's what I've got.
I don't know. You don't usually see a text that has a serious consideration of human food along with the invention of synthetic blood. That to me seems to be the key interesting thing. And the creation of a meat beast itself, you know, deserves serious consideration in its own right.
Because it's as well as like the curing the vampire. This is the end of House of Frankenstein, or the logical conclusion of that. They've developed synthetic blood, problem solved. And then the vampires go, okay, well, now we're going to solve human hunger. And the way they do that is to make an animal that is eaten. Like, it's not like a synthetic meat bulb. It's an actual creature, but they do specify that it doesn't feel pain. So I guess the question is, would you partake of the meat beast?
No.
Why not?
As you know, I'm a vegan. The idea of eating meat, like, A, I don't like meat. I don't want to eat it. Like, I don't find the concept of meat attractive. When you get, you know, fake meat or things like fakin, I don't need the allusion to the real thing.
If I ate it, would you have an ethical problem with that? Like, rather than it being a taste thing, just is it morally okay to partake of the meat beast?
I would still say no, because it's not a, like, you know, pain of course is one element, but they're still probably intelligent sentient beings that, you know, can live and love and have families and deserve to not be used for the purposes and read for the purposes of exploitation.
Yeah, the commodification is a problem, but in terms of actually eating the flesh, like, I think it's probably okay. Mm. Like, it's from an animal liberation utilitarian point of view, is by ruling out pain, there's no longer a problem. And then, as you said, then you have to get into, well, are we violating it in other ways?
Well, it would be like a vegan philosophy would say it's still wrong. Like, the use and exploitation of animals is full stop wrong, regardless of any other considerations. So whether or not it feels pain is, doesn't factor into
the argument. You have some kind of, what's it called, the symbiotic relationship where the little fish cleans the shark's teeth. We eat of the meat beast and provide it luscious grounds and protection to live.
No, but the difference there is, you know, the plankton's not eating the shark and the shark isn't eating the little fish thing either. The fish things are like eating the barnacles off.
But why is eating wrong if it doesn't feel pain and it regrows?
Because I fundamentally believe that we shouldn't eat other animals.
But why though? The reason I think we shouldn't eat animals is because it hurts and kills them. And
well, there you go. It kills them regardless of pain. It kills them.
But this doesn't kill them.
See, I also have a somewhat ethical and moral conundrum about pets because I don't think we should own pets. And I say
last
that
last night
went
off on the couch with you,
cuddling my beautiful boy Oscar. I don't know. I just don't think. Again, it's the use or purchase of animals, commodification and it for enjoyment. I just don't.
We're getting into a separate issue. Like, as far as the actual eating goes.
No, I disagree. I think it is a whole, and again, it's a vegan philosophy and a vegan perspective. Mm-hmm. It's all encompassing to me. I don't think we should have animals. We shouldn't be using animals.
Right. So just any use of an animal is by definition exploitative. Yep.
Okay. I believe. But with that said, you know, my other two cats are both adopted. So I think in instances like that where you can...
Oh, hey, it's my cat's coming in going,
yeah, I think there's also one behind you in the window.
Oh, yeah, this is Milton who, if we're going to talk about owning things, he moved in. That was his choice, okay? Like, I think he is here voluntarily. I may have tempted him with the crunchy food, but, you know, Katie's choice.
But yeah, no, they're lovely creatures. But to answer the point simply, I think I would not partake of the meat beast.
Okay. What if you came across a meat beast in the wild and the meat beast sidled up to you and went, hey, I'm about to like drop some of this, or even like, I'm feeling a bit hefty. Can you help me out here? Can you chop that off? And then if you want to eat it, that's up to you. Like this in the text, they don't seem intelligent, but I'm saying if they were intelligent and asking you to eat them, sort of like this is the cow in the Hitchhiker's Guide at the restaurant at the end of the universe. If the animal is giving you permission to eat from them, then does that solve your conundrum? No.
And even then, the fact that the way that the animal's written make you believe they're not intelligent, like it's a speciesist characterization of the animal. Like,
that's true.
I agree with this, like neo-Khan and stuff. This is where it gets silly. You know, when people say humans are as dumb as cow, I'd be like, yeah, I agree that humans are dumb, but I think cows are more intelligent. Like, in like the speciesist thinking of cows as stupid, no memory, no emotions, they just eat and shit. Yeah, I reckon that's humankind. All we do is eat and shit.
Sometimes we record podcasts. Yes, let's move on from the meat beast debate there. But I haven't seen meat beasts carried through. I mean, that's more of a science fictional thing where we end up with stuff like Oryx and Crake and the Cheeky Knobs and all of that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of vampire stuff, this is the first significant example of scientifically synthetic blood. I mean, there's the George R. R. Martin one, but I think Vampire Hunter D is far more influential, primarily through its film adaptation, which I don't think mentions the synthetic blood. I'm not sure. Mm. But on top of being the first thing of synthetic blood, Vampire Hunter D is the first vampire hunter that I can find. I mean, you have Van Helsing, but like as someone who is a professional vampire hunter, I mean, it's in his name. He seems to be the earliest of what I would think of as the modern archetype of the vampire hunter. Like before this, we sort of just have people who find themselves in the circumstances, then go research and hunt vampires. He is a dude that hunts down vampires. He is also the first half vampire hunter, which is now like a huge thing. So I just think like a really pivotal and important text in the vampire tradition, of which synthetic blood and meat beasts apparently are an important part. Another interesting example I wanted to point out is Brian Stableford's Empire of the Vampire from 1988, which is another science fiction text where we have a worldwide space vampire, scientifically enabled space vampire empire. But yes, in this book, we have worldwide immortality brought about by alien vampire DNA. So this is sort of vampires as benevolent They come and they use their science, as in Vampire Hunter D, to give humans immortality. So everyone takes drugs to be infected by this vampire thing and live forever. And then the way that society is sustained is through synthetic blood tablets mm-hmm. that they take. So this is a utopian vision of vampires that solves the feeding problem through synthetic blood. Not a notable or influential example, but an interesting one, I think.
You also have Dan Simmons' book Children of the Night from 1991, which is like a vampire techno thriller thing. But yes, in this book you have a faction of vampires who are like, they kidnap a child because he's like half vampire, and they're trying to like clone his blood so they can make synthetic blood and prolong vampire existence. It's also is a Slayer thing, because we have a the Slayer priest, the one-legged Slayer priest that becomes like the character through some of Dan Simmons' novels. It's okay. This book is too long. This book would be great if it was half as long, because it is so long. It is a bit of an average one. There's also some environmental stuff in here, and I think the environmental stuff in Children of the Night is like vampires being depicted as an environmental catastrophe. Mm-hmm. There are, yeah, likenings between them as some kind of predator species that will throw off the balance of nature and things like that. Mm-hmm. So an interesting book there. On the environmental themes, we also have Catherine Meyer Griffith's Last Vampire, one of like three or four books called The Last Vampire that come out in the early 90s. This one's from 1992 and is about what, like Native American vampire werewolves living in harmony with nature or something. This is one you discovered.
Yes. So this novel opens 6 months into the world ending, mm-hmm. And we're told that plague has been released by scientists that has ripped a new fault line across Nevada and Arizona and then California. So it's destroying all of America. There's volcanoes that are erupting. There are shockwaves that are sent across the states. Temperatures are being plunged nationwide. And there's a lot of clouds from the volcanoes and flash fires that we're told have darkened the whole nation and turned the days into a long night. Yep. So all at the same time as all this environmental catastrophe, it's revealed that a secret underground military chemical and biological weapon laboratory somewhere in Nevada has caused a plague that is sweeping across the country. We're told this sickness was 1,000 times more lethal than AIDS, and it attacks the blood. So in the midst of all this catastrophe and world-ending events, our protagonist, while she's, you know, scavenging around, I think trying to get to Canada, she's accosted by a vampire who turns her into a vampire. Anywho, she's turned into a vampire. No, he rapes her.
Very rapey, yeah.
He's really rapey. So, you know, after she's turned, our protagonist refuses to consume human blood. She refuses to take human life and become, and I quote, just what she abhorred, a ghoul, referring to the vampire that turned her. So we have, in the midst of this, an ecological catastrophe. The world is ending. A human's turned into a vampire. Then, if that wasn't enough, she falls in love with a First Nations American who is also a werewolf. And then the two of them kind of
become Does it sound familiar?
With one another and spend the rest of the world together. But yeah, and it ends with us not finding out that Ohio and Pennsylvania are underwater, that Vermont's a wasteland, burnt to a crisp or under dirty water, and that's kind of how the novel ends. It's quite apocalyptic.
I mean, yeah, I mean, we're getting the significance there, apart from just being another example of a vegetarian vampire, is this connection to environmentalism, but specifically this Native American neo-carnist environmentalism mm-hmm. that obviously gets carried through in Twilight. But also listening to you describe this book just then, I'm like, yeah, this book's sick. That sounds so cool. This book is not sick. It is not cool.
It was a shocking book.
It's so poorly written. It's very bad. She has an earlier vampire book. So yes, the year before, she also has another vampire book called Vampire Blood, which is one of the worst vampire books I've ever seen. At least the last vampire had some interesting ideas. This one is just mm-hmm. really dull vampires in a small American town sort of story. It is notable because it's about a family of vampires who move into a small town and are trying to pass, and then one of them goes rogue. And the way she goes rogue is she breaks their vow to not feed on humans and only feed on non-human animals. So a bit of a Twilight setup there. Though no one goes rogue in Twilight, but they're worried that the baby might. I still don't understand why they're so scared of the baby. Another last vampire book we get in the 90s is Christopher Pike's Last Vampire series, which is also very awful. Christoph Pike was like the R.L. Stein for teens, I think, was his deal in the 90s. Wrote just tons of like trashy horror books. In the Lost Vampire series, which I talked about a bit on the Cup of Jugum episodes, but the vampires in that are not vegetarian vampires. However, Christopher Pike's 1992 book Monster, which is not part of that series, but it's also about vampires, and I think is generally considered one of, if not his best, which is just like, what if there was a vampire that invaded a high school? So from memory, and I'm probably butchering this again, meat analogies because it's embedded into our culture, but the main character, like the high school lady, I think she finds out her cool boyfriend is actually an evil murderer vampire, and then there's like the nerd guy who, like, you know, he's in the friend zone, but he really loves her. We've got that dynamic going on. Something transpires. I think she gets turned into a vampire, and the way she takes down the evil jock vampire is by giving in and eating the nerd vampire guy to like fully like empower herself and then defeat the other vampire. Something happens like that, but I'm pretty sure she eats a dude to become more powerful. So not vegetarian, yeah. Except there is then an epilogue where she is now like just in the wilderness as like this weird like non-intelligent creature who's just driven by bloodlust, but remembers, has like an amulet that someone gave her around her neck that she looks at and remembers that humans are not food. So she is a vegetarian vampire, but she's not intelligent, and also she ate a dude.
In a lot of these texts, it does seem to get quite blurred. There's, in some of these texts, you know, there's not a straight line in the sand drawn between vegetarian and non-vegetarian.
You've also written down here, we have a TV series called Ultraviolet from 1998.
I've never actually seen it myself, but it's an example that gets brought up quite a bit.
Right, so it's just another one that has synthetic blood. All right, we'll look into that.
Something else that is taking off parallel to all of this is the popularization and prominence of tabletop role-playing games, a notable example of which is the Vampire the Masquerade series, which gets TV and video game adaptations and things. Not something I am particularly familiar with. I mean, this is... But having skimmed through some of the source books and things, I am led to understand the blood of other animals in the world of Vampire Masquerade is considered far less satisfying than human blood, restoring significantly less blood points with specifically vegetarian vampires.
Ooh.
No, I think they're not called vegetarian, but they are derogatorily referred to as farmers and vegetaries. So not vegetarians, vegetaries. Yes, the vegan was also added as a derogatory term in the 2018 fifth edition version of the series. Yes, so that is Vampire the Masquerade. Conversely, the 1991 Dungeons and Dragons novel Vampire of the Mists, which stars the purportedly vegetarian vampire elf Jander Sunstar, who finds himself in an otherworldly land where humans are kept like livestock and the blood of other animals makes him ill. Yeah, so he takes issue with the evil vampire in this world treating people like cattle. Jander himself, however, still requires human blood at regular intervals and is shown on multiple occasions preparing non-human meat meals for himself and his human victims. I mean, the role-playing games are interesting to me because this is not reading about a character, this is giving people the opportunity to embody the vampires, but it seems rather than in the literary tradition, in order for vampires to be sympathetic, they have to become more vegetarian. In the role-playing games, it's like, if you become a vampire, you don't want to be vegetarian. That's bad.
Maybe it's to do with the derogatory terms around vegetarianism in the 90s and early 2000s. Like, you think of, you know, Lisa when she's belittled by everyone for being a vegetarian. Phoebe Buffay's belittled in... Friends, like there's a
girl from Roseanne is the other one that always throw in.
Yeah, like there's just such poor treatment of vegetarians in the media.
So that brings us up to the 1990s. This, I think, is the most interesting period for vampire stuff because you have the big sympathetic shift in the 70s and some of these minor developments with things in the 80s. But the 90s is really where like vampire lore goes crazy, primarily by bringing in a lot of like science fictional elements and stuff. But it's just like when I've been going through the films, I get so bogged down on 70s and 80s films because they're just doing Dracula and Camilla and over and over again. And then you hit about 1985, 1990, and suddenly we're having original stories, original ideas being told. So a lot of exciting stuff going on in the 90s, including the solidification of the Slayer archetype that we alluded to before.
So we discussed a little bit about the Slayer archetype previously, but in the 90s, it really seems to go gangbusters with Anita Blake Vampire Hunter, which is a series of, gosh, I think there's like 20 or so books written by Laurel K. Hamilton. And it's also one of the first texts in kind of this paranormal urban fantasy genre. And at the same time, we also get kind of the emergence and the immense popularity of the paranormal romance genre, and arguably those two developments to the emergence of paranormal romance and urban fantasy go a long way in explaining the popularity and the immense amount of vampire fiction that just seems to occur in the 90s. So in Anita Blake, Vampire Hunter, we follow the titular character Anita Blake, who is this very petite, dark-haired, fetishized, petite, yet busty, badass character.
She's the femme fatale, right?
She is. She mouths off at all the characters, and she's a bit of a gunslinger, always goes it alone. And in this text, she is not only a vampire hunter, so her nickname's the executioner among vampire circles, due to her tall number of vampire kills that she accumulates over the course of the series. But she's also a necromancer. So she can, in the text, that her main form of business is she raises zombies, but she also finds that she has powers over vampires and other supernatural characters in the series.
Is she a necromancer in the first book, or does she become one?
No, she's a necromancer the entire time.
Right. So I've only read the first one, and I barely remember it, but she's yeah. sort of like the like vampire police, yeah? This is sort of that, like supernatural, that sort of premise.
Sure, they call it the Spook Squad. So the police have a spook squad that police supernatural beings at large are not just vampires, and she's hired on the case because she's known as the executioner, because she's killed a number of vampires and she holds a legal license to kill vampires, because otherwise it's considered murder in the novels.
Right.
So yeah, so she raises zombies as part of her necromancing powers, and she ends up inevitably romancing a vampire. But what is interesting about the Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series, beyond, you know, kind of being the premier text of urban fantasy, it's the first time we get a mention or a reference to vampires being vegetarian within the text or the world of the book itself. So far we've had a reference in a comic strip in a vegetarian magazine. We've also had references to vampires like Binocular and Ducula, who are actual vegetarians that don't eat meat or humans. But in this text, we have a direct quote where Anita refers to one of the vampires in book 6 of the Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series, which is the Killing Dance. And that was released in 1997. And that vampire in question is Sabine, a several hundreds year old vampire who seeks out Anita to cure him through the use of magic of some sort of disease resulting from his diet of animal blood. So notably, when Sabine explains his decision to subsist on animal blood to Anita, it is Anita and not Sabine who refers to Sabine's diet as vegetarian. Anita notes, "Your partner talked you into going vegetarian." Great.
So that is to say that they feed on non-human animals.
Yeah.
Right.
So initially we're told that Sabine tried to drink cold blood before moving to animal blood. And there's no definition or description or explanation offered in the text as to what cold blood means. Uh-huh. But presumably it is blood drawn from dead human bodies.
Yeah.
Is how I've interpreted it. And that's something that Spike also does in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which we'll get to later. But here prior to Twilight in 1997, Twilight came out in 2005, that there is an understanding that vegetarianism works as an analogy for this type of diet, if not in our human world, then at least in the narrative world of vampire fiction. So I think it's really interesting that we already have this commentary or this use of the term vegetarian to describe a vampire's diet who feeds on animal blood. Whether or not you agree with the use of the term, I know you don't, Josh, but I think it still goes to show that it works as an analogy. It's very interesting book that, you know, despite introducing the terminology of vegetarian into the world of vampire fiction, the novels as a whole are not interested in exploring the contours of a world where vampires can choose to live on animal blood and not human blood. The latest novel she released was in 2021. So we've got 20 years of text, and in only one book do we get one vampire character that feeds on animal blood. The book does offer some reasoning for this. So in the fifth book, Anita does note that theoretically vampires can drink and survive on animal blood, but in practice, animal blood seems to lack certain nutrients. She continues, truth was, feeding was too close to sex for most vampires. They weren't into bestiality, so they didn't feed off animals.
There's a lot there.
Yep. Want to unpack it?
The nutrients thing is interesting, because often where we see human blood being characterized as not preferable. It's because it tastes bad or it affects their powers or something. It's not just that it's a nutrition issue. But yes, the significance of Anita Blake for our purposes is it is the first use of the vegetarian label in text. I don't think I've come across an earlier one. I came across one earlier than Twilight, which we'll get to, but you found this one that I think is the earliest one we've got from 1997. But of course, the other significance of Anita Blake is she is pretty clearly the archetype for the other big slayer of the 90s, which is, of course, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is going on at the same time these books are coming out. Mm-hmm. The first episode comes out in 1997, the same year as the book that uses the vegetarian label. Now, I have tried so many times to watch Buffy, and I just can't. I can't do it. I can't take Xander. I can barely take Giles.
Oh, Xander is painful.
Xander fucking sucks. The only good character is Angel because he's hot and I can fix him. But other than that, I don't like anyone else in that show. So it really makes it a struggle.
I love Buffy.
Right. So why don't you tell us all about Buffy? Because this is another one of the major chapters that you look at in your book.
I guess there's two key things with Buffy. She's another version of our vampire slayer that we're tracing as part of this podcast, but we've also got two examples in this text of vegetarian vampires. Our first is Angel, and this is a really important difference to any other vampire that we're going to be looking at in this podcast. Angel's vegetarianism, so he subsists on pig's blood, is a decision that is forced upon him by a gypsy curse. So prior to Angel being Angel, he was a vampire known as Angelus, and he was the most vicious, ruthless, killing, blood-drinking bastard in all of Europe, terrorizing. In the early, I think, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, he was a bad egg. Right. He attacks and kills a gypsy, or the daughter of a gypsy, and in retribution, they put a curse on him that restores his soul, and then he feels an eternity of suffering and guilt for all the murders that he has committed up until that point. As he explains to Buffy in the seventh episode of the first season, from that day forward, he hasn't been able to feed on human blood or to kill a human because of the immense suffering that it causes him. And so for the rest of the time that he's on the series, most of the time, he sticks to his diet of pig's blood, and that earns Buffy's trust, her respect, and ultimately her love, which is another really important shift in the genre. So Buffy falling in love with Angel happens in that first season, and I guess would occur on a similar timeline to Anita falling in love with Jean-Claude, who's the vampire at the center of the Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series. But what is interesting about Buffy is that there's kind of a caveat to Angel's soul. He will lose it if he ever experiences a moment of immense happiness, and that occurs when he has sex with Buffy for the first time. A lot of critics will read it as a condemnation and a warning not to engage in premarital teenage sex because Buffy sleeps with Angel and then he, you know, leaves her the next day. It's that classic trope of you sleep with a boy and then he tosses you out into the cold and doesn't talk to you and you're all upset. But as soon as they have sex, and it's depicted at the moment of ejaculation, just to make it that point all the more drive home, he turns back or reverts to the blood-sucking, nasty Angelus, and he does things like kills Giles's partner and leaves her posed dead naked on his bed. So Giles comes home expecting a hot date and then sees his naked, dead, contorted partner. And Angelus even torments Buffy, so he becomes a real prick, and she ends up killing him, sending him to hell, and then he's resurrected. The second vampire we get in the series, who I think is far more interesting, is Spike, who's our cockney accented speaking leather cladded Billy Idol bad boy who loves the dog races, follows Manchester United, smokes, drinks, drives a car, loves a good time. And you can already see from that list he's quite a humanized vampire. He has human interests and he likes the human world. And in season two, when Buffy faces one of the many apocalypses that threaten to destroy the world, Spike teams up with Buffy, and his reason for doing so is that he likes the dog racing. He likes Manchester United. He doesn't want the world to end, which is quite funny. So Spike's set up as an antagonist from the start of season two. He's infamous for being a vampire slayer killer. So he's killed something like two or three slayers in his time, and therefore is a huge risk to Buffy. Until season four, he's captured by the Initiative, which is a government-funded military research laboratory where Army Corps soldiers, they insert a microchip into his mind. And It's called behavioral modification circuitry. And so every time he thinks about hurting a human or goes to hurt a human, he gets like an electric shock. So it's like electroshock therapy in different ways. And so that kind of kickstarts Spike's vegetarian journey. He's no longer able to feed on humans. Mm-hmm. So he then starts drinking pig's blood out of necessity. And then that, you know, introduces a whole host of differences in the text where, again, he gains Buffy's trust. They become friends. They also engage in a really kind of violent and horrific sexual relationship, which a lot of critics also take ire with. But yeah, so we get two examples of vegetarian vampires within a Vampire Slayer series, and she beds both of them and kind of falls in love with both of them, which is pretty radical when she's meant to, you know, be killing them, but she doesn't.
So I think we've got a couple of things going on here. I mean, a Vampire Slayer thing. Mm-hmm. So we have that development, but yes, part of them being good is they have to be vegetarian, which is interesting that in both cases they are sort of coerced into that. It's not a voluntary...
Yeah, not voluntary at all, which is really interesting because I don't think there's an involuntary, apart from maybe Dr. Wayland in the Vampire Tapestries would be the only vampire that's forced to feed this way.
The other thing that's going on there that we will get to is parallel to this, we also have the development of the, what I like to call, but you don't, the beloved vampire, mm-hmm. but the idea of the vampire as a lover, right? Anita Blake and Buffy are both sleeping with these vampires, which I don't think really happens in the earlier sympathetic vampire portrayals, like Louis and Lestat are not. He's a weird pedophile, but only after he's turned the girl into a vampire. He's not. Mm-hmm. He doesn't take human lovers. Which another thing that's happening parallel to this is in 1994, we get the film of Interview with the Vampires, which takes it into the mainstream rather than just being this weird goth book that the goths like. So yeah, there's something going on here. Well, there is a movement of these common tropes being popularized. But another Slayer we get, another hugely influential Slayer that we get in the 90s is Blade, or the Blade film. Blade is a Marvel character, but he's not actually half vampire in the comics until after the film. So again, I think that's, in terms of half vampire slayers, we have a more direct lineage to Vampire Hunter D here. Mm-hmm. But in the Blade films, Blade is able to satiate his vampire thirst through a synthetic vampire serum. Mm-hmm. And this is the first film comes out in 1998, which on top of just being awesome, is, I think, understated, like just how influential the Blade film has been. Like, it predates the Matrix by a year, obviously sets up Underworld and things like that. Like, in terms of leather clad karate movies, Blade is sort of ground zero for that, while also tying in vegetarian vampire ideas and philosophies. The reason Blade has to use a synthetic serum, though, is not out of choice. It's because he's actually allergic to animal blood. So again, as with Spike and Angel, it's sort of coercion or circumstance rather than a philosophy that promotes his vegetarian vampirism. But yes, Blade, a hugely influential film, most directly on the Underworld franchise, which begins in 2003 and kicks all kinds of ass. But notably in there, it is said it's just a throwaway line, but it is established in the first Underworld film that the vampires in the Underworld universe are meant to feed only on animal blood. Mm. And that they own a company that is attempting to clone human plasma, and that the evil vampire, Victor, in the first one, like, the reason he is not a good vampire is because it turns out actually he likes to feed on people instead. So, like, it's sort of subtle, even though none of that all sounds subtle, but it is just like one line of dialogue that when they're just doing their lore dump gets thrown out. But at the crux of the vampire morality in the Underworld series is this philosophy and ideal of a vegetarian vampirism.
Mm. We seem to be entering now a phase where morality or some sort of, you know, underwriting philosophy is emerging in these texts that we didn't quite have.
What year does Twilight come out? Is it 2004?
2005.
2005. So yeah, this Underworld film is a couple of years before that, which we will talk more about in the later episode. But to finish up this one, we need to talk about the other major development of the 90s, which is this. You know, we're calling him beloved. What do you want me to call him? The vampire lover.
Romantic vampire.
Problem with romantic is it can apply to Interview with the Vampire, and that they are romantic in terms of romanticism.
There's no romantic inter-species relations.
But they are romantic in that they are Shelley and Byron.
They may be romanticized.
Yes.
But there's no romantic.
So what's your problem with beloved as a label? Because for me, it's pretty, like, it's a clear-cut transition from vampires we have sympathy with to vampires we now want to, we actively associate with and have sexual relations with.
Well, I guess my issue with it is a certain critic, Deborah Dudak, has a book called The Beloved Vampire, which is where this label comes from. But she argues that the vegetarian vampire is a development of the beloved vampire. So in these texts, vampires learn to eat morally because of the humans they love. It's not a love development. And I want to make that crystal clear. And it should be clear through the text that we've, you know, stepped through. love is not a motivating factor in any of the 80s or the 70s or the 60s. In terms of vampires choosing to stop drinking human blood, it's not motivated by love.
So I fully agree with that. So I guess when I say beloved vampire, I am talking about a vampire that is beloved. Like the vegetarianism isn't part of that. I mean, I think it is a common trope of that, but in terms of definitionally, vegetarian vampires, or whatever we want to call them, human abstinent vampires and beloved vampires are separate categories, separate but massively overlapping. To me, beloved doesn't imply vegetarian.
No. Would you say they're separate categories or all subcategories of the sympathetic vampire?
The beloved vampire is a subcategory or development of the sympathetic vampire. If all vegetarian vampires and all beloved vampires are sympathetic vampires, but not all vegetarian vampires are beloved vampires, and maybe not all beloved vampires are vegetarian vampires, that is sort of how I would look at it. But yes, when I say beloved vampire, I just mean a vampire boyfriend.
Yeah.
Which, yes, is popularized massively through Twilight in the early 2000s, but is preceded by at least 15 years by the Vampire Diaries book series, which then gets turned into a TV series after Twilight. So that is often considered the start of this trend, the first Vampire Diaries novel from 1991. But Sophie, is it the start of this trend?
No, it is not, Joshua. Thank you for that throw. Now, I'm not going to take credit for this because it was Joseph Crawford in his book, Twilight of the Gothic, which is all about tracing the paranormal romantic shift in vampire fiction from its inception all the way to the current day. There's this 1990 novel called The Silver Kiss by Annette Klaus. And what's interesting about The Silver Kiss is pretty much does everything that The Vampire Diaries does a year later. So we have kind of the inaugural small town American vampire story that's centered on a teenage female protagonist who falls in love with a male vampire. So we've got the small town setting, the high school setting, the pairing of a female human with a male vampire. And over the course of the series, they get together, he bites her, they share blood. And then she helps the vampire, who is Simon, dispatch his brother Christopher, who's an evil, like, five-year-old vampire. So he lures in women with this, like, you know, sad sack, I'm a lost orphan baby story, and then proceeds to violently kill and rape them. It's quite sadistic. What's interesting to me, and you can see the link between the two, is that Simon in this novel is a vegetarian vampire who feeds exclusively on birds. And there's a scene where the female protagonist catches him in the act of feeding on this bird, and that's how she discovers that he's a vampire. That exact setup happens in The Vampire Diaries a year later. So in 1991 with The Awakening, where Elena, who's our human protagonist, walks in on Stefan Salvatore, who's one of the vampire brothers in the series.
Stefan, who is legally distinct from Simon. Like, this is when you're saying this, these book series share a lot of common elements. They share the entire plot.
Oh, yeah, it's the whole plot. So then, Silver Kiss's plot, to go back, is girl meets vampire boy, girl and vampire boy fall in love, girl helps vampire boy kill bad vampire brother. And bad here means human blood drinking and murdering, and good means non-human blood drinking and murdering. Vampire Diaries, you have Elena, human girl, meets vampire boy, falls in love, shares blood, helps vampire boy get rid of the older brother.
I mean, the reveal of the evil twin brother really is the thing where it's like, this isn't a coincidence, right? Like,
so they're not twins, but they're very similar. The key difference in this novel is at the end of the first book, Elena is turned into a vampire. Damon turns her into a vampire. And in Silver Kiss, the good vampire dies. He goes, fuck it, I'm sick of being a vampire. I'm out of here. And so he leaves the human protagonist, and Zoe goes on to live her life. But you can see, you know, that small town American setting, it's high school, it's teenagers, female falls in love with a male. I don't need to rehash the whole thing. But there is that scene where Elena walks into a room and finds Stefan, like, crouched and growling and beating on this dove. And it's literally just, like, taken out of The Silver Kiss and pasted in The Vampire Diaries. It changes after that, but it's pretty similar.
There's the same thing with The Vampire Tape and Interview with a Vampire, which I was saying, like, there probably wasn't a coincidence, but, like, those books share a basic premise. This shares, like, specific plot detail. So I don't know, like, could L.J. Smith have read The Silver Kiss and ripped it off?
Yeah, it's just so similar. So it's not The Vampire Diaries that, you know, first introduces the vampire boyfriend that was the Silver Kiss first.
Right. So this is the beginning of the beloved vampire or the vampire boyfriend trend, whatever you want to call it, that really gets popularized and takes off post-Twilight. So we will be talking about that in a later episode, which is to say that, yes, we will be covering Twilight and everything after and a few things before, right? The 2000s and onwards, the 21st century vegetarian vampire craze in a later episode. But before that, another thing that is happening in the 90s and the 80s, but parallel to the things we have been talking about, is, of course, the Discworld series and its development of vegetarian vampires. So the next episode in the feed will be about that.
Bye.
And we're clear.